Hello, I'm Johan Birch, but you probably remember me as the Stairmaster in The People Under the Stairs. I'm here to let you know that the Rants from the Black Lodge podcast are reviewing that very movie. So drop what you're doing and download now. And please, please stay safe. Rock on.
Live from the Black Lodge, it's me, the free will burning, head turning, ass kicking, machismo dripping, master podcast and mouthpiece of the Southeast, Brandon A. Lane, bringing you a new edition of the Rants from the Black Lodge podcast. August 30th, 2015, genre filmmaking legend Wes Craven left this mortal realm and ascended into the void of the unknown. Tonight we attempt to shine a light into the darkness and pay tribute to the man with the retrospective of one of his most macabre masterpieces, the criminally underrated The People Under the Stairs. Now this monumental undertaking of paying respects to the master is one I am unqualified to do on my own, so it was with the utmost pleasure to have the Stairmaster himself, Johan Birch, provide that incredible intro at the top of this episode. Now, I want all of you out there in the Rant Army to track Johan down on Twitter and give him a follow at Johan Birch. But the party does not stop there, because his castmate, Sean Whalen, but you probably remember him better and more fondly as the character of Roach, will be joining us later in the episode to tell an amazing story about Wes Craven on the set of this film. But first, here's some messages from our sponsors.
Next Generation Wrestling brings some of the most talked about and star-studded professional wrestlers from around the world. Based out of East Tennessee, NGW is becoming one of the most sought-after independent wrestling promotions in the past 4 years. Witness NGW Live or on demand on the High Spots Wrestling Network streaming app. Follow us on social media platforms at NextGenTN.
All right, Rant Army, tonight we take a dark journey below the stairs and into the twisted catacombs, better known as the imagination of the gone but never forgotten Wes Craven, as we dive deep into his 1991 urban nightmare, The People Under the Stairs. And who better to analyze the plight of an impoverished African-American community than two painfully white dumbasses? Without further ado, I'm your host, Brandon A. Lane, and with me, as always, is the Bruce Campbell to my Sam Raimi, my good friend and yours, the alcoholic mastodon, Fat Tony.
Hello, yes, I can't wait to speak about the great perception and depth that the very whitest man on earth, White Craven, puts into 90s urban decay.
So here we go. The People Under the Stairs was released November 1st, 1991, on a budget which was estimated at $6 million. Adjusted for inflation, that comes to roughly $11.5 million. That, even in today's
money, that's super low budget. It's all on the screen,
though. Low budget.
But yeah, it's not a cheap-looking movie.
No, it doesn't. This movie, especially in 90s terms, looks very cinematic. It's not flat. It doesn't. I mean, this is pre-digital, but you know, I kind of associate 90s movies with that kind of flat digital look. But it still looks like a very cinematic movie, especially for the low budget. You put it perfectly. Everything is on screen. Now, at the box office for its opening weekend, it came in at $5,522,250, which basically made its budget back
in
the first weekend. And adjusted for inflation, that comes to roughly $10.5 million. At the domestic box office gross for its entirety here in America, that comes to $24,204,154. Adjusted for inflation, that comes to $45.5 million. This was a huge success.
That's why horror movies themselves are always great investments, you know, low risk, high reward.
Before we like branch out and we kind of tell the story of this movie, this was a really big hit. I mean, it was number one at the box office, I want to say, for like 5 or 6 weeks. But when I think about Wes Craven movies, for whatever reason, this is kind of lower on the totem pole. Now, I hold it in higher regard, but I'm saying for like public perception.
Oh, yeah, it's one of those, oh, yeah, I forgot he did that, but oh, that movie's fucking weird.
that it is. And that weirdness transcribed to a worldwide gross of $31,347,154. Adjusted for inflation, that comes just under $59 million.
I do have to say this. Did they only open it in like England and then Canada? Because that's just $6 million more on top of...
Well, you gotta think, like, the American film market is...
It's now more universal.
Yeah, but at that point, like, that's basically what it was. And now a lot of movies hinge on...
China.
How does it do in China? And
fucking commies.
we won't get into the whole China debate of how they've ruined movies because of this whole thing. But you know, at the time, this was a runaway success. But I feel in some regards it's been kind of forgotten. But at the time, it was fairly critically praised.
Well, this is one of those movies that I did not get to see in the theater. I was like 10 when it came out, but I remember the marketing. I remember being like, oh my god, I want to see this. So like the day it came out on video, like I was up there, I had either didn't have school that day or it was summertime, because my dad's boss owned a video store, Movies and More, over near the old Food Lion. And
oh yeah,
So I was there at 10 a.m. when they opened, so I could go grab it and rent it, and like no parents at home. I was left home alone during the summers. It was great. And like this was like one of the, there's a lot of, I have theories on Wes Craven movies, the good, the bad, the weird. This is the last one. I was just telling you that like he goes balls out weird. Like this is like, it's not a super gory movie. There's one moment of, hey, that's pretty fucking gory, but like the concept, execution, and everything in this is fucked up when you really think about it. You know, it's like Last House on the Left, not as realistic seeming. It's more surreal.
Very unglamorous in its depiction of violence, which is kind of strange because this movie has a comedic tone that we're going to get into a little later on, but those mixture of things that Craven has always utilized, but I think he really cranks up the comedy in this movie, which you can see as a positive or a negative, and we'll assert that as we continue on. Now, the critics were a lot more positive on this movie than I think probably audiences were at the time. And, you know, over time, it's sort of flipped where now it has a really strong cult following, but maybe the critics are not as kind. Whatever.
Well, the early 90s was the time of the urban blight movies. You know, I think this came out before Boys in the Hood.
Well, this came out in 1991, and I want to say that Boys in the Hood was...
92, 93?
Maybe.
Something like that, you know, but these movies were...
Sorry, John Singleton, I don't remember when your movie...
Sorry. But, you know, that kind of stuff was getting... Oh, he's drawing attention to... Even though through the lens of a white guy. But, you know, drawing attention to all these problems and social satire. And, you know, this movie's deeper than you think. And really, it is and it isn't. Because, again, it's handled in my... We'll get into it later, but not great. But not bad. I mean, there was good intention behind his social messaging of the movie.
I'm going to interject because and we'll talk about this as we continue on, but yes, this is coming from a white man's viewpoint of what's going on, but it was well-intentioned, and I think he uses the ridiculousness of this movie to kind of to prove a point about what was going on. Because you got to think, we're about a year out. A year later was when the L.A. riots happened.
Yeah.
So we're in the thick of, like, I mean, I know things are bad now with, you know, between...
Always bad, but...
You know, the black and white racism issues between political parties and socio-economical stuff. But during this point, I mean, it was like the urban story was about to become headline news. But getting back to the critical praise, this movie on Rotten Tomatoes has a 62%, which I think is a little low, but that's from, I'm viewing this through the lens of like regular people that are not horror movie fans.
Oh, I know, I get it.
That's probably fair.
I understand that. Like I would, again, this is not top tier Wes Craven to me. This is like cream of the crop for his second tier movies. But, you know, I put it, me personally, I'd give it a 70%, 75%. There's a lot of flaws.
Like, I think up until a point, basically before the third act, I would give this movie about an 85%. And then the third act is kind of rushed, and I think that knocks the movie down, and we'll talk about that as we go on. The audience score is at a 58%. I think that's a little low, but yet again, I'm going to put that through the lens of not just horror movie fans, but just general moviegoers.
What's good? Okay, we'll get to Google. Google.
IMDb has it a 6.4 out of 10, which that's probably fair. I would put it maybe about a 7.5.
Yes.
Metacritic has it a 57 out of 100. I think that's low. Google users, 91%.
Whoa, my people. The good people of Google users. They always have my back.
Me personally, I think I would put it between 85 and 87.
75 to 85 to me, that's me.
But, you know, I think this is a crowd pleaser movie, more so today than it probably was then.
Yeah, fuck rich white people.
Shudder, our good friends at Shudder, have it at a 4.4 out of 5.
For horror movie fans, that's right on the money.
That's right on the money. I agree with you. And Empire, 4 out of 5. Empire is a publication that sort of caters to strictly straight-up movie fans, so I found that kind of interesting that they would have it so high. But Wes Craven's work has been reevaluated time and time again, and I think people, when they dig deeper, they're able to see things that, beyond the veneer, that there was more thought put into this than probably there were a lot of movies during that time. Well, his contemporaries.
It's like, you don't like Scream. I love Scream. I think it's a modern masterpiece. I get it. But, you know, again, maybe one day you'll reevaluate it, and then maybe one day you'll watch the Evil Dead remake.
So. It is inevitable. We will do Scream on this podcast, and I will watch it through.
And I will cut that motherfucker if I'm not on here.
I will review it through contemporary eyes. I won't put it through the bias I had back in 1996 when I was in sixth grade, because I was just pissed off. So we'll cross that bridge when we come to it. And in terms of the people under the stairs, on Fat Tony's hit list, we've got
5.
We have 5 dead bodies. 6 if you include the Rottweiler named Prince, R.I.P. You never want to see an animal get killed. And there's that old adage that you never work with kids, you never work with animals. And this movie has both. So credit to Wes Craven for being able to get performances out of both, because I think he does an excellent job in that front.
Yeah, and, you know, well, are you counting all the skulls and dead pieces of bodies you see?
No, I know.
You see 5 people get killed, 6 if you count the dog, which I didn't used to be a dog lover, but my lovely fiance Sarah has made me a dog lover, so I'm going to count.
I love dogs. I'm a big purveyor of dog culture.
I don't like
doggos, man.
I don't like racist dogs. I'm glad he died.
Oh, he's...
It's the owner, not the dog,
he's,
I know.
He's a poor kid grew up. I mean, you could probably draw parallels between that and just, you know, sort of the themes of the film. You know, it's the growing up and the...
He's made it to be.
Nature versus nurture, and he was nurtured into becoming a racist dog. To be fair, they are trying to rob
that. Yeah, they are. I mean, he's being a good boy in his mind.
That is a fucking scary dog, though.
That it really is.
Yeah, they
I grew up afraid of dogs, and by the time, I think I was 12, but, you know, because it took like a year for movies to come out on video back in the day, so I was 12 when I saw it, and I'd kind of outgrown my fear of them, but there was always a little bit like, the movie Cujo fucked me up.
Oh, it fucked up Danny Pintaro, too.
Yeah, that's true. But, you know, now, at the time, I wasn't so... Because there had also been, like, K-9 and other dumb dog movies out around that time.
Wait a minute, that's the one with Jim Belushi, right?
No, that's the one with... No, not K-9. I'm saying K-9. No, it's the killer dog movie with Lance Hendrickson.
Man's Best Friend.
Man's Best Friend. K-9's, yeah, Jim Belushi, and then there's Turner and Hooch.
I fucking love
those movies also got me over my fear of dogs.
Turner and Hooch is a sad fucking movie.
Broke my soul. I don't care that he had puppies. I want Hooch back, damn it.
On Stank Dick Eddie's Titty Tally, man, I want to say, 2020 has been a trying year for everybody, and I don't want to make light of the people that are out there who are genuinely suffering, but in context of this podcast, the greatest travesty that has fallen us is the 2020 Stank Dick Eddie titty drought, because this movie has zero titties, and I feel like this year we have just hit the wall when it comes to breasts.
I think next year or next month needs to be sorority girls at the Slime Ball Bowl-a-rama, something with guaranteed titties.
Like a Russ Meyer movie? Super Vixens.
We're just going to do Super Vixens.
It's just 20 minutes of just bouncing, a static shot of titties.
Let's
bouncing.
Let's just do The Room. At least there's titties in The Room.
That there are. Thank you, Danielle.
That would be a five-hour podcast. Between me and you talking about The Room. It'd have to be a two-parter.
The idiosyncrasies of that film.
He's an alien fuck machine, okay?
He was supposed to be a fucking vampire, and he had a flying car, but we don't see that in the film. That's all subtext. If you don't pick up on it, then you don't understand film.
Exactly.
All right, let's drop
move on to the movie at hand, The Wonderful People Under the Stairs.
The story of The People Under the Stairs is very much the story of its creator, none other than the legendary horror auteur Wes Craven.
He was a young minority in urban sprawl trying to provide for his family? I didn't know that. I'm just playing.
No, he was not. But we'll put into context why he wrote this type of film. So to properly examine his films, we have to examine the circumstances from the point A to point B. So let's go from page to screen. Wesley Earl Craven was born August 2nd, 1939, to a strict Baptist couple, Caroline and Paul Craven. His religious backgrounds fostered an outwardly quiet and reserved man who would excel in the fields of psychology, English, but he gained an undergraduate degree from Wheaton College and a master's degree from philosophy from John Hopkins. His academic endeavors led to teaching English and being a humanities professor. However, his strict religious background had bred somewhat of a rebellious spark.
As it does, because me being a product of church school.
And he left the academic field and entered into the field of what I found. I think I knew this, but it didn't really hit me until doing this research. He entered the world of pornography.
Yes.
And which began his directing career. Now, Craven's talent behind the camera didn't go unnoticed, and he was persuaded to undertake a different genre. Wes had this to say about moving into the horror field. As a producer said, make a horror movie. I said, well, I've never seen one. He said, you're a fundamentalist. You must have demons rattling around in there. Now, in the 1970s... it was sort of seen as like horror was only a small step up from pornography. It shows you how much like times have changed. So it was like a natural transition from movies to where people fuck to where somebody gets fucked. The film The Last House on the Left and The World of Horror was never the same.
It's only a movie.
In the preceding decade, Craven goes on to create hit film after hit film, which leads us to 1991's The People Under the Stairs. Now, routinely using real-world events as the basis for films, Wes based the plot of The People Under the Stairs from a 1978 news story where two African-American burglars made a forced entry into a house in Los Angeles, California, which unintentionally led to the local law enforcement discovering a pair of children who had been locked away by their parents, never allowed to go outside. He always had this knack for taking real world things and sort of weaving it into a contemporary, you know, kind of nightmare scenario. He did that with Nightmare on Elm Street, almost like a Cambodian refugee.
Yeah, some kind of Asian, like, yeah, those refugee guys and the dude died, like not more than one dying from. I really, now knowing that, I want to know the story behind Shocker.
Well, there was a guy who stuck his finger to an electric socket and was able to shoot through TVs.
He killed a guy. He killed a couple people before then. So.
That old chestnut. Not to jump off topic, but how novel it is to have a television repairman. The year that we live in, our technology is so disposable that like the thought of like repairing television is just like...
Okay, ridiculous. I really recently, within the past 6 months, tried to watch this with my stepdaughters and their friend, and they had that same fucking question. I'm like, I don't know. You just throw it away now. Back then, it was a fixture, a piece of furniture in your house with wood and American sweat and labor on it.
Don't get me wrong. They still exist. But they're very much a niche thing. And it's funny because television is such a fixture, especially in, like, cinephiles and, you know, movie buffs. But it's so more... It's cheaper to buy a new TV than it ever was, you know, like the technology that we have now. You can buy a 60-inch TV for what it would cost to buy a 20-inch TV 20 years ago. So that's just the world we live in. But back to the people under the stairs. Like many of Wes's films before and after, its immediate success, it opened at number one at the box office, and it stayed there for like quite a while. Now, 30 years later, we ask the question, why is The People Under the Stairs not better remembered? Now, before we answer that, Fat Tony, if you'd be kind enough to read the synopsis for the urban fairy tale that is The People Under the Stairs.
Really dark fucking fairy tale. Wes Craven, the director of A Nightmare on Elm Street, locks you inside the most terrifying house on the street. Trapped inside a fortified home owned by a mysterious couple, a young boy is suddenly thrust into a nightmare. The boy quickly learns the true nature of the house's homicidal inhabitants and the secret creatures hidden deep within the house. Stunning visual highlights, this inventive film that the San Francisco Chronicle calls Wes Craven's most satisfying movie. That's music from the heart. Everybody knows that.
I don't blame him for making that.
Good for him, but I watched it once and...
I love Meryl Streep as much as anybody else, but I couldn't bring myself to watch it. And that's no knock on Wes Craven, who, it's sad in one regard, got stuck making horror films. But at the same time, you were so fucking good at it. So I hope that he, you know, because he's left this mortal coil, and I hope
R.I.P.
I hope he didn't regret that this was the situation he was thrust into. Through his endeavors. Because, well, I mean, I guess a filmmaker's goal is to be able to make, you know, personal films. But I feel like he imprinted a lot of himself onto the films he got to make.
Yes,
so, I mean, he definitely made an impact.
Most directors only get one genre-defining, groundbreaking moment. He kind of got two and a half. I'm going to count Last House on the Left as a half. Because the 70s were a real fucked up time for horror movies anyway. But he kind of got it on the ground early. Then Nightmare on Elm Street spawned a huge franchise. Moves on, okay, everything. Then Scream. You know, much as you can debate the merits of it, you can't debate the impact of it.
Oh, definitely
for
not.
Good or ill. Mostly ill, I think. But I love that movie. But, I mean, he got to do it, like I said, several times. But, you know, he died knowing that he was an inferior filmmaker to Tommy Wiseau and will never achieve such heights of cinematic greatness.
I know that you speak partly in jest. I won't say entirely, because we do love
Tommy. There's like a 60-40 joke.
The People Under the Stairs has many highlights, from its stellar production design, engaging acting, and its gruesome makeup effects, but its nucleus, at its creative core, you have to bend a knee to its writer and director, Wes Craven. Now, more than anything else, I want this episode to kind of be a tribute to Wes Craven. Now, when we did our Nightmare 2 episode, I was a little hard on Wes, and I want to kind of redirect in my statement in this. A lot of people have think that I have, because of what I said, that I don't like Wes Craven as a filmmaker. That's not true. I simply think that his strengths are as a writer rather than a director. But I will say this. This may be top three material as far as the things he's directed.
Yeah. I mean, I'd have to really think about that, but I have no initial knee-jerk arguments to that, so...
This is a really nice-looking movie.
My personal favorite movie directed by him, visually, is Serpent and Rainbow.
Oh, that's a fucking terrific movie.
Yeah.
Terrific movie. Let's break down what Wes Craven has done, and we'll try to be, you know, do the Cliff Notes version, because otherwise we'll be talking about Wes Craven forever. Last House on the Left,
classic.
One of the most brutal films ever made, because it does not glamorize violence, and it's stark, it's bleak, it's a type of film that you watch and is hard to watch multiple times because he doesn't make the violence fun. Like, Friday the 13th, we'll talk about especially the sequels, where, like, the kills are just center point, and you want to see Jason dispatch these people. You don't like seeing these characters get killed because you build that first half an hour is building a rapport with them, and then when they get dispatched by Krug and his just villainous team of miscreants, you feel for them.
That's Wes Craven's genius, I think, as an overall filmmaker, is you don't ever like seeing the people in his movies die.
That's the worst.
Yeah, like, you know, he always humanizes his victims and doesn't glamorize the violence. So that's what makes a Wes Craven movie to me a Wes Craven movie.
He also did The Hills Have Eyes, which is a masterpiece. He also did Part 2, where a dog has a flashback, and I will bring that up every podcast that it's applicable, because a fucking dog has a flashback!
It was a cheap money grab movie.
He actually held off on releasing that, because he knew that, like, he could have an ace in the hole. Like, if I need money, I can release this, and it'll make money just off the reputation of the first movie. But he held off until Nightmare on Elm Street hit. So I respect him in that front, but oh man,
it's a bad movie.
That movie is not. That movie sucks. That's
easily his worst movie.
Yeah, I'm not even gonna argue with you because you're probably right. He did Swamp Thing with Adrian Barbeau, and depending on whether or not you get the American cut or the international cut, you might get to see some boobies. Serpent in the Rainbow, which we just mentioned, absolutely terrific film, especially in a decade where I don't identify horror as being Paramount, but it's probably the most genuine representation of voodoo ever put on film. You know, it's not hokey. They try to get into, like, the weeds of, like, what the genuine religious aspects are of that film. So a lot of respect to Wes for elevating, you know, what could have been a very
schlocky,
hokey premise. Shocker, I love it.
Fucking love it. We got to do that one day, and oh my god, it's an underrated masterpiece.
It was a misfire from Universal because they wanted their own Freddy Krueger.
Then he tried to give them their Freddy Krueger, but if you polish that a little bit, you have a true gem of a movie, and I fucking love it.
I think Shocker.
Although the star of it went on to direct the movie Battleship, so may he rot in hell. I had to watch that.
The protagonist?
The protagonist of that movie went on to direct the movie Battleship.
I did not know
He's directed several bad, like, okay to bad movies.
However, Mitch Pileggi went on to be in The X-Files, and we love him forever for that. He did Scream 1 through 4. He just directed those. He didn't write them. Kevin Williamson wrote 1, 2, and 4, I believe. He didn't write Part 3, and that's why that's the worst of the series.
And Courtney Cox's bangs.
Oh, fuck, man. Courtney Cox in the 90s. Ugh.
Pete, but those bangs in Part 3, fucking, that was, no.
Nobody gets a boner from that. And if you do, you might want to go have your eyes checked. He's probably most beloved as the creator of Freddy Krueger. And how can we discount that?
No.
Freddy Krueger is a screen icon. One of the top five greatest villains, not just horror movie villains, but just greatest villains of, you know, cinema ever. Although he didn't play so much a hand in the directing, but he did write the first draft of Nightmare 3, which everybody loves, and he returned to the series with Wes Craven's New Nightmare, which is arguably...
It's my second or third favorite. It's probably my third favorite one in the whole series. Three or one, and they can switch position on any day. The ones he was directly involved with are basically all my favorites.
We've been over this. Yeah. My favorite is Part 2, because I think it's the most viscerally nasty movie. But objectively, if you were to just view it through the lens of, like, how Freddy Krueger was intended, 1, 3, 7.
Yeah.
Those are the best ones. Yes. And the Craven trilogy. Even though, like, Part 7 really isn't a part of it.
It's a meta-trend, it's a meta-con, blah, blah, blah. But it's great.
But, yeah, and, man, what a concept to have.
Exactly.
During the time, because this, yet again, it's pre-Scream, and you have a character that exists with outside of his own genre, you know, franchise. That's a novel concept even today, but back then, I'm sure the movie made money, but
yeah.
I mean, I don't think any of them lost money. But, man, what a shot in the dark to take. Very, very creative. And that goes a lot to talk about just the why Wes Craven is considered one of the greats. Now, we've lived a very full and fruitful life through the benefit of Wes Craven's work. And he left an incredible body of just content as a writer and as a director, but I want to mainly focus on his skills as a writer. Craven, in critical terms, was held in a higher regard than a lot of his contemporaries because of his weaving of political and social issues into his films. Now, many critics have dubbed his, John Carpenter's, and George Romero's work as elevated horror. So my question to you, Fat Tony, why do you think Wes Craven is held in a higher regard than a lot of the other filmmakers in the horror genre at the time?
Okay, Wes Craven always knew he had a job to do, and that's upset the audience. But he didn't just do that. His movies are not just, hey, let's show some tits, have a good couple of gross kills. There's always something on a deeper, more visceral level, an intellectual level even. You know, like, again, like I said, what makes a Wes Craven movie to me is he humanizes all the victims. You know, even the dumb throwaway kills in the Scream sequels, you know, which he didn't write those, but, you know, he always directs them, you know, in any of the other movies, you care about those, but they're humans getting killed, not just slasher fodder.
Yeah, not stereotypes.
And, you know, he always, again, I get the elevated horror idea because he's not just content giving you a product that's fun. If he seems interested in all the things he wrote and directed or wrote, they have an interest for him. He's not just doing it for a paycheck. You can argue shocker. Again, I love it.
Well, what was the later movie you and I watched together?
My Soul to Take. There's a lot of good things. Like, I mean, it's not a great movie, but there was like that one moment where they kill the football douche and he regret, I never got to see my unborn child. I'm like, God damn, that hit you hard.
Yeah.
I mean, there's lots of flaws in that.
Well, even though there was the intent, like by the hierarchy of the film production to like, hey, create us a franchise, he still tried his best to give you something that was above and beyond.
Yeah, it's not just...
So, My next question to you would, do you consider The People Under the Stairs elevated horror?
Abso-fucking-lutely.
I'm going to agree with you, because this premise in novice hands would be...
Really bad.
Really bad.
Yes.
Because this very easily could just have devolved into like a circus of... of, you know, playing whites against blacks. And there is a very subtlety used in the racial issues here. Probably not to the degree it probably should have been or could have been, but he definitely tries to elevate it to a terms that make where middle America would understand why this is bad rather than hammering it in such a way that, like, where you're like, oh, this is just SJW bullshit.
And I'm going to give him credit and walk back something I just said because something just hit me. You know, like, this is a white guy, like, the whitest white guy ever's view on urban youth and decay. But if you think about it, he doesn't really, I mean, it is, there's racial elements to the antagonist of the movie, but it's not really a white and black movie. It's a rich and poor movie.
Oh, yeah.
It's more class than race-based, which... I think his audience could understand on a greater level. He's still exposing the problems of racism and all that stuff, but he also subtly to be like, hey, these are rich assholes.
Well, there's the great scene towards the end of the movie where Fool's grandfather and his sister come to kind of confront Mommy. And she's just about to say the N-word when the lawn fills up with just hundreds of people from the neighborhood. So there definitely is that racial element. And I think he does a pretty good job in context of 1991
yes.
white guy point of view of bringing...
He's like white-splaining racism, but it's well-intentioned.
Well-intentioned. Now, I think you and I could both agree that whether it's The Exorcist, The Shining, Hereditary, that we both love elevated horror, but we also love good old-fashioned schlock. Now, ultimately, taste is subjective, but you can't deny Craven's intention in approaching, you know, how he approached writing horror. Wes had this to say. When you have an idea that really fascinates you and... You can honestly say, I have never seen anything like that. You get the audience, and they go out and they tell everybody. And the reason they do this is that they've never seen anything like it. You're trying to be avant-garde in horror. There's something That's where you want to be, where horror movies have to show something that has never shown before. The audience is completely taken back. You see, it's not just people who want to be scared. People are scared. Now, jumbled as that may be, there really, if you break it down, the core of that is true. I don't think I go to horror movies wanting to be scared. I mean, I guess you could break that into a primordial kind of, we're jaded and we want to be.
I want to feel something.
But when a horror movie genuinely does scare you, it's because you do have fear in you.
Yeah.
And it's sort of highlighting that. So to me, elevated horror is being able to cut through the veneer of things and to be able to just focus in on a very specific thing. And whether it, you know, it makes you jump out of your chair or you just have a sense of dread leaving the theater, that's a very, very impactful thing. Now, prior to the People Under the Stairs, I don't recall any urban-centric horror movies. I mean, there was Blackula and Sugar Hill and their great blaxploitation fun, but as far as mainstream horror goes, I think this may be the first. So you have a fresh setting and a mix of economic disparity, and you end up with a fairly original idea. So I want to talk about the societal issues. Now, bear in mind, almost a year to the day, this is before the L.A. riots.
Okay, I'm going to interject. When did Candyman come out?
1992. So okay, this is before.
It's pre-Candyman. Okay, I was thinking they might be close.
And this is the reason, and I want to point this out, I think this is why Candyman is a classic, whereas the People Under the Stairs is kind of forgotten, because this is right before
it's Black Christmas to John Carpenter's Halloween.
That is an excellent analogy. So why do you think we kind of touched on this before, but the societal impact, I think if this movie had come out a year later, that we probably would be talking about this movie in more of a minor classic terms than we are now.
Yeah, I think because it does predate the riots and other stuff, it was a precursor to a problem that existed for decades before. It was, again, like the first toe in the water of mainstream cinema acknowledging like that. It's not in horror, mainstream horror cinema. There have been plenty of good urban black movies and stuff trying to be socially conscious before
that. Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing, I want to say that was
88
maybe.
88, 89, somewhere.
But you have to think, probably people in Oklahoma aren't watching.
They're not going to go watch Do the Right Thing, but they might, oh shit, the guy did Nightmare on Elm Street's got a new movie. Although Oklahoma doesn't have that southern accent, but oh, golly gee, we're in Minnesota. We're going to go see People Under the Stairs. But, you know, again,
oh my God, they have People Under the Stairs.
Again, so many things.
How many people are under the stairs? I need to know.
I'd say 2070. but, like, again, it predates the riots. That brought it to the front. Candyman, R.I.P. Wes Craven, Candyman to me, and this, again, subjective, is a better movie. Like, it's not as weird. It is not as fucked up. Like, I'm sorry. Like, it's weird and fucked up. But it is. Tony Todd was so iconic as that true first, African American icon of horror. There had been other, like you said, Blackula and all that stuff. Tony Todd owned it. Blackenstein.
Tony Todd. I've had the pleasure of meeting Tony Todd. And if, you know, in the million year chance to one, I would love to have him on the podcast, and I can't entirely rule that out. Mixtron, if you hook us up, because our good friend Mixtron worked on Candyman. But you're right, it was on the forefront of all that. It released at the right time, and it's classic in ways that, like, other 90s horror films are not. I mean, including Scream. I mean, Scream is
late 90s.
Mid-90s. But to me, there are three big ones from the 90s. There's Silence of the Lambs, and I don't give a fuck what you say.
It's an elevated slasher movie.
It's an elevated slasher movie. A guy who takes fat women and cuts her skin off. That's a fucking horror movie. you've got Candyman, and you've got Scream. That's the big three of the 90s. And I won't discount the popularity or the impact, but to me, the chief among them is Candyman. So,
fuck yeah.
And a lot of that has to do with timing, but Candyman is just a really interesting story, and it weaves both slasher tropes and social commentary into it in a way that is more organic. And this movie is more satirical than Candyman.
Candyman does not have much comedy. Levity to lessen the bleakness, because I mean this movie does. Again, I don't know. I might be, if I'm stepping on something, I'll wait till. But the antagonists, the actors playing them, were probably chosen for a reason because of something else popular in the 90s and also used in the name of the podcast.
We'll definitely get to
that.
Okay,
I'll hold
up. We're going to be talking about that. I think it's pretty clear that the antagonist, Mommy and Daddy, who we'll discuss more in a little later on, are avatars for an uncaring and amoral ruling class, a.k.a., you know, i.e. the
fuck
ruling
rich whitey
class,
man.
The one percenters. And Wes had this to say about those types. It seems like all powerful people on Earth just want to build condos and knock down all the trees. As somebody once said with wonderful succinctness, the golf course is man's boot on the neck of nature. Before we move past that statement, that's a pretty good outlook on what this movie is about.
Absolutely.
It's the, let's rid the, our 1950s nuclear family white world of the black varmen, and we'll cater to white people, and we'll build a utopia in this urban, you know, on the foundation of the rubble of this urban nightmare. For many people, the People Under the Stairs is kind of an urban fairy tale. And one of the reoccurring themes in Craven's work is distaste for religion. Though Wes was raised as Baptist, and by his fundamental faith-based mother, Craven later became a staunch atheist. He once told Fangoria magazine that, this is a quote, "Formally, I do not believe in God because I think people's minds are too limited to have a concept of whether there is a God. And I may have religious... I believe religions have done more harm than they've done good." So, before we get to the societal stuff, because we're going to talk about the LA riots and the circumstances that urban America was dealing with at the time, but the religious themes in The People Under the Stairs, they're not subtle. They're very they're very heavy-handed, and this is something I find in a lot of Stephen King's work as well. Being kind of biting about the religious right,
which is funny because he's not an atheist.
Well, that is an interesting point, but he definitely has a distaste for
fundamentalist Christians. No.
So let's talk about the themes in the movie. The characters of Mommy and Daddy are kind of
hear no evil, speak no evil, see no evil. They're just perfect.
You grew up in a fundamentalist, religious homestead.
My parents were, like, my mom a little bit more so than my dad was hardcore into it. But, I mean, home, it was school that I really was like, you're going to hell for everything you like and do.
What kind of impact does that have you on you, you know, like,
I
now?
Hate, like, I don't hate people that go to church. I hate the church they go to 9 times out of 10. There's always good stories of it. There's good people in everywhere. And people, if they do things that are good and kind for their fellow man because they're inspired by their religion, that's great. But all I see, the examples my brain picks out are all like, you know, I'm not going to sell a wedding cake because you're gay, or I'm not going to do this, and... Like, I hate it because I love Chick-fil-A, but I won't eat there anymore. Like, they are so... Like, they have actively given money to people, to charities that have ruined people's lives for being gay or something like that. Just, I have a lot of contempt for organized religion. I'll just say that. Sorry, people.
Well, at least I'm not going to take a stance one way or the other, but I will say this. Like, it all boils down to a human element. Where I know that there are good people that are religious.
Exactly.
And there are
bad people
who are religious.
And there's asshole atheists, too. I don't like asshole atheists as much as I dislike fundamentalist Christians.
So, I mean, but the themes of religion are very fundamental in horror. It's sort of... We've reaped the benefits from it existing because it lays a groundwork of morality in horror films. We're able to build upon that. It's sort of a
Jason Voorhees is a Trumper. No, this thought just occurred to me. I just kind of lost it. Like, horror is so great because, lots of people, they talk about, it's your fear of mortality is why people like horror. It's also fear of immortality, the immortal soul. Like, that's why it can be so oh, I'm going to hell for watching this, and you kind of get a thrill out of it. Because I really did. My mom was like, if you could watch these without this, your soul's hardened and you're damned. And I kind of wanted to ride that line as a kid when I still kind of believed, I want to because I like it. And there's a very transgressive appeal to it. Like, that was my teenage rebellion.
Well, put that in perspective. Do you think that's why it's fundamentally loved across the world? Or is that something that's more just specific to you? I mean, is it because...
It might be specific to me and my ilk. Like, Wes Craven would get what I'm saying. Like, ooh, this is kind of dang it. Like, he just went whole hog into pornography. He went a lot harder than me, but a lot sooner, a lot quicker. I just, my first was, watching little horror movies on the side and, Ghostbusters and just more and more into that. But, somebody that grew up in that kind of thing, when they finally are free themselves of the demon that is their religious dogma, now they just, I love, the worst, most awful movies just because, I can.
We both share that because we have really fucked up sensibilities.
Yeah.
And it's something that's all rooted in just kind of general horror films, but, you kind of lose the feeling you get over time, and then you want to go deeper and deeper.
Or there are, speaking of elevated horror, I just want to give a quick shout out to Gretel and Hansel. Movie's fucking great.
I haven't seen it. I've heard good things. It's on my watch list. Let's move on. The movie is dark as its subject matter, but it still managed to deliver quite a few laughs. The movie was hailed at the time critically for its use of humor, but the reaction from its fans was more understandably mixed. So my question to you, was Wes Craven right to inject the film with comedy, or would it have been better served?
I think it would have been a scarier, more disturbed film played straight. But he knew what he was doing, getting the actors he picked to play Mommy and Daddy, and having fun with it. I think it probably allowed it to be a bigger success, definitely. If you played that movie fucking straight, no, it's going to be another Last House on the Left situation. Only hardcore horror movie fans are going to like it. These are people that kidnap and kill children. If you don't have their, stabbed a dog, and you just dumb shit of Mommy and Daddy, and their humor. And it's also his way, I think, of also kind of throwing shade to use, actually, it's not even modern parlance, that's already outdated too, on the rich and whitey and all that. It's to make them such buffoons and idiots that it helped his message of the movie more, but it definitely made it less scary. I was never at once all scared of those two people. When Daddy pops out with a gimp suit, even as a 12-year-old, I'm like, what the fuck? But
yeah, I agree. I don't think this is a super scary movie.
He didn't really want it. If Wes Craven wanted to be scary, it would have been fucking terrifying. But he wanted it to be satire. And probably I've never really heard it talked about urban fairy tale, but that's very apt and accurate.
To me, the movie it's scary more in theme than it is in content.
Exactly.
It's just the idea that this could happen. Comedy aside, the film has a strange, subversive tone that personally I think, at least in part, was inspired by Twin Peaks.
Absolutely.
I have no proof of that aside from sharing a couple of cast members, and I'd like to get your take on that, Tony. But first, Wes had this to say about subverting the expectations of the audience. What you want to do is you want to put your audience off balance. You have to be aware of what the audience expectations are, and then you have to pervert them. Basically, hit them upside the head from a direction they weren't looking for.
He did that 100%. Okay, I'm sorry, I interrupted.
No, you're right. And rewatching this movie this past week, I knew the big points in my head, but I was really taken back about how quickly this movie changes tones from one thing to another thing. And a lot of that, and this is me being a Twin Peaks fan, I can't help but think that some of this is derived from Twin Peaks.
I am 100% in agreement. Twin Peaks is juxtaposing weird, fucked up shit next to, like, Norman Rockwell normal, which is kind of Mommy and Daddy on the outside.
Yeah,
the
ritual. Yeah.
He uses two of the cast members, like, from that show, who are amazing, and I love them in both. Although, I like, seeing her without the eye patch, because I've been recently rewatching all the, like, it threw me off, because when I rewatched People Under the Stairs with Sarah, I'm like, I wanted to have an eye patch, damn it, and talk about, like, curtain rods. But, and again, it wouldn't seem that far-fetched for that character to be like, ah, it's so loud! But, so, I think it's 100%, and again, that made such an impact at the time, even though, at the time, it was a very, for mainstream popularity, Twin Peaks was a blip. It came and went, two seasons. Now, the people who love it, love it.
Yeah, you're right. At the time...
Who, like, killed Laura Palmer was the most important question ever.
That first season, like, completely changed the landscape. And the series going into even the third season, like, it is so jarring. Because you can't plant your foot on, like, this is what the show is. Because within 20 minutes, you're going to be on a completely different path. And I feel like, tonally, this movie has a lot of parallels. And I know for a fact, another movie that would come out a little later, Freddy's Dead, pulls heavily yes. from this. So you have to think that, like, it's sort of in the ether. People are like, maybe we can apply what's working so well on television into this movie. But you got to think, by the time this movie came out, Twin Peaks had already, in a sense, had already died a fatal death, because the network forced, you know, him to reveal the killer in Twin Peaks, him being David Lynch. But it was still sort of like this new, fresh idea that you can blend genre and subvert people's expectations of what they were getting into. I just don't know that this movie does it well.
I have to say this for me. The name of the movie, again, based on the advertising campaign and the name of the movie, I thought the bad guys would be the people under the stairs, not the victims. They're dangerous and creepy looking.
Oh, yeah, that's a great subversion.
But that in and of itself is the subversion. The burglars are the good guys, which you kind of know going in, because they're not going to make some little kid a fucking villain. But, you know, these people are trying to rob this couple. They're normally they're the bad guys. They need to die. But what, again, like the real story, it's so much worse what Mommy and Daddy are doing that, you know, you forget after like 40 minutes of the movie, you forget that he was there to rob the place. Because, again, fuck rich white people is should be the alternate title of the movie. Fuck these particular rich white people. Not all of them. I'm sure there's one good one. But, no.
Elon Musk.
No, he's a dick. No, definitely not Elon Musk. But, no, like, that movie, it keeps subverting expectations. Again, like I said, when he pops out with a fucking gimp suit and a shotgun, I still, like, that's one of my most vivid memories of the movie, watching it on video. Like, what the fuck?
Listen, one of the other main criticisms of the film was its similarities to Home Alone, which had been released almost a year to the date before The People Under the Stairs. So, you know, elephant in the room, the movie has several traps, and they are reminiscent of those that appear in Home Alone. Let's break them down. We have barricaded doors, we have spikes through the walls, stairs to the basement that turn into a chute, trip wires, electric door handle that shock a dog, and I will never laugh at a dog being hurt in a movie. That's always funny. now, to the layman, these items appear to be rip-offs, at worst, homages, but Craven fans know that he has some weird fetish for, like, Rube Goldberg-style booby traps. So let's talk about Wes Craven's obsessions with traps. So, going back to The Hills Have Eyes, the whole third act of that movie is the build-up to them killing Papa Jupiter. And they have this, like, rope that pulls him through, like almost like a something out of a Looney Tunes movie. And then, you know, Nightmare on Elm Street, you have the whole setup where Nancy pulls Freddy out of the dream, and there's trip wires and exploding
the light bulbs and the sledgehammer. I want to say this. I'm not trying to make Wes Craven seem to be a pretentious asshole. I just don't see him seeing Home Alone. Like, I'm sure he's aware of it because it was in the cultural zeitgeist at the time. But secondary knowledge at best is what I see Wes Craven having of this.
So I understand when, like, the few negative reviews they got at the time sort of drawing parallels, but if anything, Home Alone rips off Nightmare on Elm Street.
Exactly. That's what, and those reviewers are racist.
Yeah, listen, there's precedent that the traps were ripped off from Home Alone.
But the effect of the traps certainly wasn't. Like, you know, most of the traps from Home Alone would have killed a person. As they do in, you know, or attempt to in this movie, not Home Alone.
In the gritty Zack Snyder reboot of Home Alone, they will kill.
Did you ever see Better Watch Out where they did the paint can thing?
No, I have not. I have not seen it.
Yeah, they do a paint can thing and it kills a dude.
Well, good. I'm in favor of people being killed by paint cans. There's only one scene in the People Under the Stairs that I feel like you could directly say is ripped off from Home Alone or the ilk of that, because it's completely played for comedic purposes. And so towards the end of the movie, you have your female and your male protagonist, Fool, and A.J. Langer's character, Alice.
Yeah.
They're on the roof, and they're making noise, and Daddy is, like, hearing them in the chimney. So, you know, he's shooting and stuff, and they drop a fucking brick on his head. And that's so fucking Looney Tunes.
It is. Comedic. And again, that would probably kill somebody, and it doesn't in this movie. So, yeah, I agree with that one.
So, I will suspend, you know, my belief that's probably as close as you can draw. That may have been inspired because
all the other stuff, he loves traps. That's not really a trap. That's just a, like you said, Looney Tunes.
That's something straight out of an episode of The Three Stooges.
Exactly.
Good stuff. I'm all for physical harm to people through
drugs. I'm Stooges till I die, baby.
Listen, we could talk about Wes Craven all day long, and he'll certainly be a fixture in the discussion as we continue on down the line, but let's move on to our antagonist. Hell hath no fury like a woman scorned, and the matriarch of this hellish family is no exception. We have Wendy Roby playing the role of Mommy. Now, she has a pretty packed film career. We'll touch on that. She was in The Glimmer Man with Steven Seagal, Devil in the Flesh with Rose McGowan. Many a night spent abusing my undercarriage to that film back in the day, even though there's no fucking nudity of Rose McGowan, but I was very fond of that back in the day. Love you, Rose. Best part of Scream, Rose McGowan and her pokey nips of that sweater.
I was always on the Nev Campbell side of things.
I don't know, man. I just don't find Nev Campbell
to this day.
Yeah, well, you can have Nev. I'll take.
There we go.
I'll take crazy
in this made up dream world. Yeah. We'll just decide who we have.
She was in The Dentist 2, which was directed by Brian Usna, and the only reason I'm pointing this out is I actually talked to Brian the other day, trying to get him to come on the podcast. So those of you out there in the Iran Army, if you want Brian Usna on this podcast, please reach out to him on social media and demand it. So perhaps we'll be able to get him on for a podcast for Brighter Reanimator. Or society. A lot we could talk about.
Society's the first one. There's my knee-jerk reaction for him.
She was in Vampire in Brooklyn with Eddie Murphy, who was in Trading Places, who was in... Dan Aykroyd was in Ghostbusters, so there you have it. You just got busted.
That's a double busted because Eddie Murphy was supposed to be in Ghostbusters.
That he was. That he was, and then the film got rewrote. All those films aside, Wendy is best remembered as the neurotic, eye-patch-wearing Nadine Hurley in all three scenes of the Twin Peaks. Wendy's character of Mommy is only half the equation, so we also have the predatory patriarch of the clan, Everett McGill, as Daddy. He was in Quest for Fire. Did you ever see that?
About
the cavemen.
Caveman.
It's a very, it's a movie that probably would not work very
well
in
theaters today.
Wait,
is that the one with Radon Chong?
It is.
Okay, yes, I have seen that one.
Everything's grunts and growls. He was Stilgar in David Lynch's Dune. We've kind of touched on Dune before. probably not the best adaptation, but the best adaptation that could have been hoped for under the circumstances.
They got a bunch of the small details right.
That's true. Poor David Lynch. That's the one movie he's...
It took Alan Smithy now.
He was in, he being Everett McGill, was in Heartbreak Ridge, Ridge with Clint Eastwood. He was in the James Bond film, License to Kill.
My least favorite James Bond movie.
You could argue which of the two Timothy Dalton James Bond movies are better or worse, and I would agree probably in principle with both, but neither probably best lettered left
them.
At the bottom of the pile. Much like Wendy Roby, Everett McGill is remembered for his role as Big Ed Hurley in Twin Peaks. So normally we'd break down the characters separately, but because these characters prey and slay together, we shall discuss them in tandem. And the first thing I want to draw attention to is their character motivations. Aside from being like an incestuous, gun-toting, sadomasochistic child abusers, Mommy and Daddy are landlords. Fool's mother, who is bedridden with cancer, is 3 days late on the rent. Therefore, the fine has become triple and must be paid immediately or they will be evicted. Mommy and Daddy are more than hopeful they can get Fool and their family out of the building so they can tear it down and, quote-unquote, whiten up the neighborhood. Right off the bat, Craven has established them as deplorable people on the inside, but he also has an interesting choice about Mommy and Daddy aesthetically. So I want to get your take on this. Do you think Mommy and Daddy intentionally were made to resemble Ronald Reagan and Nancy Reagan?
Oh, yeah. Wes Craven, like, he does stuff, and it's usually not with a lot of subtlety. And, like, 91 was... That was HW, right?
No, it's right after...
We're coming off the Reagan times. I don't think it was... If he did, it was... It was just an extraordinary coincidence.
Well, watching it back, more so than Ronald, I'd gotten Nancy Reagan vibes from fucking Wendy Roby, like, hardcore.
Says with a boner in his pants.
Completely separate from this. I had saw this thing on YouTube. Somebody had done a really good documentary about kind of like drug PSAs in the 1980s, and... Nancy Reagan was fucking all over those things, and she did an episode of Webster or Different Strokes, rather. And I don't know, it's just something about how she delivered the lines that really made me think about Wendy Roby in this movie. So I may be just putting things together that aren't necessarily there, but I definitely think aesthetically, that's got to be intentional.
It could have just been in the air and just a coincidence, but I don't think so.
It's pretty clear that whether or not they're supposed to be direct avatars of Ronald and Nancy, that Mommy and Daddy are a commentary on the social elite. You know, they're bigoted, greedy, incensed that their neighborhood is filled, for lack of a better word, blacks. Although perverted, they justify their misdeeds as being godly, and they have this catchphrase, "May they burn in hell."
Bad girls burn in hell. They'll burn in hell. but also all rich white people fuck their siblings. So I mean that's fact. It's annoying.
We'll get to that. This line of "May they burn in hell" is used for comedic intentions, but the scenes are genuinely effective where Mommy gives Alice a bath.
Scalding hot bath's fucked up.
So the whole like religious parallels we've touched on with Wes Craven, they really come into play with these scenes right here, where we're taking religious dogma and using it in a really, really ungodly way, for the lack of a better word. She has this great line where she says, "The water is hot, but the fires of hell are hotter." Total to Wes Craven for nailing the dialogue.
Somebody, one of his family members said that. That's too good to just come out of the ether. He's heard somebody say that. Something's hot, but the fires of hell are hotter. I'm not saying he was forced into a scalding hot bath.
But then again, I mean, it's very possible. He's touched on his religious background, but he never really came out and said 100%. I know his father died when he was around 4, and it's hard to, like, form memories, yeah. Like, but I don't know. I get the sense that maybe some of this stuff is personal to him.
Yeah.
But all the same, that's a fucking terrific scene. It's one of the highlights of the movie to me. Scalding hot water.
And and when she's making her clean up the blood and then yelling at her for getting her dress dirty. Like, that was like, you bitch, oh God. Like, you just hate her.
We'll talk a little later about AJ Langer's performance, but, like, she has full-on PTSD in this movie, and total credit to being able, at that young of an age, I think she was 17, and being able to really pull that off. Listen, we have so much to discuss regarding Mommy and Daddy, including incest, child abduction, child abuse, child molestation, and we're going to deep dive into those
normal
things.
Rich, white people stuff.
Pretty much, yeah, totally. Later in the podcast. But first, let's discuss AJ Langer as in the role of Alice. Actually, you know what? Let's hold off. I want to talk about Poindexter being the character of Fool first. One of the few actors of that era, being a kid actor, not to go off the deep end and have a bunch of drug problems, which is, you know, thankful for him. Especially when you consider that he was Zeke in Michael Jackson's Moonwalker. wasn't molested, to my knowledge. I've stated on the podcast before, I don't believe Michael Jackson molested those people. But yet again, I'm a white guy who doesn't know anything. I wasn't there, so it's very possible. But thankfully, he doesn't
appear
to be.
This one got away.
He doesn't appear to be one of those. You know, he was Kenny in the Sandlot, very popular 90s film. One of the better movies.
That's one of the best movies of the kids movies of the 90s.
He was also a Jesse in the Mighty Ducks 1 and 2. And I'm actually going to draw some parallels a little later on with the Mighty Ducks, so hang on to that.
I can't wait for that.
Not related to the people under the stairs.
Oh, okay.
And in recent years, you can hear him lending his voice to the popular video game Kingdom Hearts 2. Now, many critics were very positive about Brennan's acting ability, and I think those reviews were well-earned. Unlike many other child actors, we've chronicled, you know, downward spirals on previous episodes, Brandon seemed to stay grounded and not let the limelight go to his head. He had this to say about fame. It's not the part of being a celebrity that's so attractive to me. It's being recognized for your accomplishments and what you've done. Being closer to what you want to achieve in life. So, he's really natural in this movie.
Yeah.
He's one of the better child actors, especially in the 1980s was kind of like the child actor movement, like the lot of Disney movies in the early mid-90s.
It all started with when Kurt Russell murdered Walt Disney, because that was the last thing Walt Disney wrote. But, you know, yeah, it's like they did start getting better and better, like.
But even during that time, like, even the ones who were good were, like, TV good.
TV good.
But, like, there's the realism to him. Like, he's very casual. And I feel like, especially the scenes he shares with the character that Ving Rhames plays,
yes.
Like they have a really good rapport, and he doesn't seem like he's reading off a script. It's very, very natural, quick-witted. I really, really like his performance in this movie. And the other thing I guess we need to talk about is him not becoming a statistic in Hollywood. I mean,
good on you, mate.
It's like he's like, it's funny because this movie is focusing on the one percenters in a societal kind of standard, but as far as like child actors, he is the 1% because he didn't end up completely fucked up and, you know, in a heroin den someplace.
You know, there's one worse fate doing non-sexual roles in pornographic movies, like the guy from The Toy and fucking Christmas Story and a bunch of other shit.
Scotty Schwartz, is that his name?
I think so. Scotty's X-Rated Adventure. He did porno.
But he didn't do porn?
He did porn, but then there was a lot of roles where he did non-pornographic roles in pornos. That's as low as you can get. If you're not at least fucking somebody on film, you know, at least heroin and stuff, you feel good.
Oh, man.
The non-pornographic roles, you just go in there and have to smell lube and ball sweat and get, like, a little bit of money for your trouble.
Well, I feel bad for him now.
Yeah, that's as low.
Let's start a GoFundMe campaign to get him acting in porn again.
Is he like 60 in pornographic now? Roles.
Yes, and
that's why science made Viagra. See Alice, so he's ready to go anytime.
Poor redheaded kid. Brandon Adams was born in Topeka, Kansas, which is, you know, as middle America gets. But he grew up in California, and like most film actors, he had this to say about growing up there. I grew up in Inglewood, L.A., and South Central. I was always humbled by my situation. I would go on set, come home to my neighborhood and my block of friends, and it would be a whole other story. So you may be asking yourself, what the fuck does that have to do with the people under the stairs? Now, directly, the answer is nothing, but in doing research specifically about Inglewood, it took me down the racist rabbit hole. Here's the Cliff Notes history, and I'll attempt to weave it back into perspective to Fool's character and themes of the movie. So back in the 1920s and the 30s, the Ku Klux Klan were very active in Inglewood, and there was a concerted effort to keep it 100% segregated. There was a hotly debated trial that led to the outlawing of the Klan in California, thankfully, but at that point, the damage had been done. And by the 60s, there were only 29 people of color living in Inglewood.
Damn.
Just to put it in perspective, out of the total population of 63,390 people, only 29. And it wasn't until 1969, there was even a black police officer, and schools remained segregated until 1970. There were many white owners of housing who were implementing an illegal, quote-unquote, race tax or black tax to slowly price people out of living in these areas so they could whiten the area up and rebuild and cater to high-income white families. Now, despite this, and as slow as it was, there was progress. In 1983, Edward Vincent became Inglewood's first black mayor. In that decade, Inglewood became the first city in California to declare the birthday of Martin Luther King as a holiday, which resulted in a mass exodus of white families. Therefore,
that's fucked up.
It is more integrated because of this. It's a weird way to go about it, but that's just the way it was. Now, fast forward another decade in time, and you're at the filming of The People Under the Stairs, and race relations are in the shitter. I can't know for certain, but I would have to say that it's likely that growing up in that area, Brandon Adams would have seen or have been a direct victim of racism and classism to some extent. And I can't help but see the parallels between Inglewood's history and the themes of The People Under the
Absolutely.
Stairs. So my question to you being, between Inglewood's history and Brandon Adams being uniquely qualified for the role, do you think that that adds something to him being uniquely qualified for it because of the surroundings? Like,
well, given the background,
I know, I'm not interjecting, but I know that acting is,
you're supposed to be able to do it no matter what.
Yeah, but I have to think that like somewhat of his background had to lead to.
Corey Feldman couldn't have done it.
Well, no. Corey Feldman's actually not a very good actor. And I'm sorry, Corey, if you ever hear this. I love you, but you're not a very good actor.
But no, I do think that it might help. Yeah, absolutely. Like, again, I didn't know, but I've always thought he was great in the movie. In fact, it's probably my favorite role he's been in the movie. I probably like Sam, like growing up, like Sandlot a little bit more than People Under the Stairs. But yeah, I mean, yeah, he definitely has been a experienced racism in his life before that movie, and then he's doing a movie about, you know, what he thinks, you know, what normal rich white folk do. It's a documentary.
The thing that I really like about the movie,
nothing, not even a titter.
I like a lot about it. The thing I like about it is that even though it really does paint a racist viewpoint, it's not anti-white. It's the way it
anti-greed.
It's anti-greed. Yeah, you're right. But it doesn't paint all white people as racist. It paints only a small subsect of racists.
The 1% of people, you could say.
Oh man. But it is done in a very satirical way. But I sometimes think that works better in the context of film because you're selling sensation, and it's easier to convey real life terms of something if you kind of fluff it up, and I don't want to
have
some
entertaining behind it.
Yeah,
like there's a movie. I just had the name right before I said it. The zombie movie on Shudder where Native people are immune. This one, like Native population, are like genetically immune to this zombie virus.
Shit, I know what you're about.
It has the same kind of theme, social importance, but it's a fun ass movie. Like I just watched it last night. It is amazing. Quantum. I don't know. I'm sorry. Blood Quantum.
Yes,
that's it.
Yes, I haven't watched it yet, but
it's, again, I saw the trailer. You have to take whatever kind of social messaging you have and wrap it up in an entertaining movie or experience for people, because especially if they're not suffering. You know, white middle America is not suffering from, you know, oppression by racist landlords. You need something to get that to draw notice to that.
Well, I think there's a line to be drawn of like how you approach this material, and I think he did a very good job.
He doesn't beat
for, you. For 1991 yes. standards of like, hey, this is going on. Because
he's as woke as you can be.
Yeah. I think like you can go too far with this.
Where, oh,
like,
absolutely.
You're, like, where it's sort of like you're demonizing just, you know, race for the sake of gender. Race for the sake of demonizing a race, but it's
you're
not
race baiting to get attention. If handled wrongly, you know, you're just like, look at this, bro. You know, you're stirring the hornet's nest with nothing to say.
Now, aside from the parallels between Inglewood and the themes of The People Under the Stairs, there is also parallels between the plot of the film and the reasons for Brandon Adams' character being nicknamed Fool. Now, we haven't done one of these in a while, but I think it's a perfect excuse for another rants recreation.
Before we get into this, this actress who plays his sister Ruby, I can only think of this and Nightmare on Elm Street 4, and I think she did TV work.
As 5 as she's in.
Oh, my God. Oh, 5. Yeah, duh. Shame on me. Dream Child. I had such a crush on her because of her voice, and this movie does it the most. The opening dialogue between them.
Well, don't fall in love with me when I recreate it. Because I'm going to be playing the role of Ruby.
No promises.
So, the scene that Fat Tony and I will be recreating is literally from the first of the film. It's exchange dialogue between Brandon Adams and the role of Fool, as portrayed by Fat Tony, and the sister Ruby, played by Kelly Jo Minter, or in this occasion, be played by me. Me, 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 me.
Me, me, me.
Swords and staves. Tough road got this year. Judgment, death, and the devil. Glad it's your birthday, reading and not mine. Now here's your card, Fool. See? That's where I got your nickname.
Don't remind me.
Here you go, 13 today. But golden-haired birthday boy is setting off on a life's big adventure.
I ain't no golden-haired nobody. And all I'm going off to is 7th grade.
Well, you the fool. And you can't escape that. That ain't bad.
No?
No, ain't that stupid kind of fool. Only the ignorant kind, because you're just starting out.
Well, that's better, I guess.
Ah, but look here. Already he's got a problem. See? One step in front.
The drop-off. What about the dog?
That's Fool's companion, see? Spirit barking, fool. Don't go marching over that cliff now. Do the smart thing. The high thing.
So what fool going to do if he ain't going to do, go off the cliff, fly?
You ain't going to do what you have to, you going to do what you have to, fool. Turn around and walk the other way, right through the fire of the sun.
He get burned up if he do that.
Just the boy part get burned up. Let's go out the other side of man. No one calls him fool again. Now we're laughing, but... Let's talk about...
Nice little atmospheric open that pretty much lays out the whole movie for you. But I do have this criticism. That woman's voice is sexy because it's husky. And they're like, I should have done Ruby because I would have done a better job. Oh, fool. Oh, my God.
I apologize that my voice...
It's not sexy enough.
I have been accused of such things, and you are... I'm 100%
guilty. No, he's definitely
guilty.
Sexy enough for himself. He just does. He can't live up to Ruby's high standard.
Let's talk about. Before we get into like the discussion we're about to have, I want to talk about Chekhov's gun. It's a principle in writing. Chekhov's gun is a dramatic principle that states that every element in a story must be necessary and irrelevant elements should be removed. Elements should not appear to make false promises. By never coming into play. The statement is recorded in letters by Russian playwright Anton Chekhov several times, with some variations, with the best example being given that if a story introduces a gun in your first act, it must be utilized in the third, otherwise it was completely needless, thus Chekhov's gun. Now, the interesting thing that this movie does is that it's not a MacGuffin that's introduced that comes back into play. He's literally... given you the theme, the thematic plot,
yeah, of the movie. Most general synopsis of the whole story, how it goes.
is his entire character arc of him having to become the man of the house. I mean, his mother is, you know, afflicted with cancer, and they can't pay the rent, and
you can't have this, get the surgery.
You know, it's yeah. a it's a really humbling experience, because I mean, he's on the 13th. I know that going back to like Jewish tradition, the 13th year, that's where you become a man. And I know that's probably not as applicable to this scenario, but in terms of like, you know,
13 is that time when puberty starts to hit and you start to grow up, and you know, you do transition from boy to man. That's kind of the general vague area, not Jewish tradition withstanding or not, you know. So I mean, it's thematically it fits.
Yeah, I agree. The thematic nature of it, although I mean, like, I wouldn't trust a 13-year-old
fuck no
with fucking anything.
No,
I was a shithead when I was 13.
I was a monster. Like, maybe, like, I wouldn't let a 13-year-old microwave my food. I've been poisoned by the 13-year-old I live with. She put hand sanitizer in my chili once, and I ate it so fast, I only tasted it after I swallowed.
Wow.
Thanks, Amelia.
Fat Tony.
Yeah. I lived up to my name that day. There's just a little bit left. And I went, gobble, gobble, gobble. What's that? Bleh. So I still like to say to this day, you poisoned me.
You know, all the same, you know, reality aside, 13 being sort of like this marker for now, you're entering the next phase of your life. You're putting aside childish things and you're growing into the person that you will become.
You start to do drugs, worship Satan, all the fun stuff.
All the good stuff. And if you're going to do drugs, make sure it's at 13.
Yeah. No 12-year-old smoking the devil's lettuce before then.
Through the course of the film, we see Full evolve figuratively from a boy to a man, but he's not the only character who sees tremendous growth. A.J. Langer in the role of Alice in her film debut, as was Brandon Adams. This was also his film debut. Alice, and this is the Mighty Ducks comparison I'm about to make, she was in 18 episodes of a show called Drexler's Class. It was a sitcom starring Dabney Coleman, who's, you know, a businessman who is forced to become a teacher at a school. It's basically the exact same plot as the Mighty Ducks, rather than Gordon Bombay getting a DUI and being forced to coach, you know, little league hockey.
That's how life works.
Yeah, I know, right? The 90s.
Yeah, the 90s.
But AJ plays Melissa, who is one of Dabney Coleman's children. The other daughter he has, in her second on-screen performance, was Brittany Murphy. She's left us, unfortunately. The voice of Luann.
Luann, I was fixing to say, that's my favorite.
That's her best role. Absolute best
role. Fight me.
We will
physically fight you over that.
AJ has done tons of television work. She was in Baywatch, Coach, Seinfeld, Touched by an Angel. But most recently, you've probably seen her on... Well, I haven't seen her. If you are a woman, you have probably seen her on the spinoff of Grey's Anatomy, Private Practice. I don't know of many men that are watching this
show. How sexist. I love that show. I'm riveted every... I have no idea. I didn't know Grey's Anatomy was still on, let alone had a spinoff.
Well, unfortunately... because women have to have... That's you have Pornhub for men, and there's Private Practice and Grey's Anatomy for women. That's their pornography. Let's not deny that's what it is.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds sexist, but, you know, we're men, not, so we're right.
Okay, it's softcore pornography
it's
for them.
It's pseudo-porn.
The hardcore pornography is Hallmark Channel. That's where they really diddle their
expectations.
No,
I'm going to give women better. The hardcore pornography is hardcore porn, but it's hardcore mom porn is Hallmark movies.
Okay, fair enough. I'll relax.
I say mom in the general demeaning, mansplaining sense, not the actual. You, just because you're a mom, you can let your freak flag fly. Love you, sir.
Ooh, my. But that's not what we're here to talk about tonight. Yeah, watching back The People Under the Stairs this past week, I was struck by a couple of things in relation to the character of Alice. To the highlight better of what I'm driving at, here's an exchange between her and Full. Full states, "What about you? How come they haven't put you in the cellar? Alice, I don't see or hear or speak evil. It's the only way." It's pretty clear that the character of Alice has been a victim of abuse in many forms and is suffering from some form of PTSD, and kudos to AJ because her acting is really believable. I want to talk about AJ's performance in relation to child abuse. Now, child abuse is a horrible thing, and I don't want to make light of it, like, in any regard, but it's hard to purvey that on screen, and I hope to God that she's not a victim of it, but there's a quality to her performance that is so vacant of humanity, or that's probably not the best way to put it. It's like vacant of expectation of reality, where there's just a dead behind the eyes quality to her, and she's so fucking scared that I can't help be drawn to that character. And it's not something that most characters are going to be, or most actors are just going to be able to turn on and turn off. For me, her performance is something that transcends. Fat Tony, what do you think about AJ's performance as far as it relates to her portraying a victim of...
I think it's the linchpin of the entire serious side of the movie. Like, you got the goofy, crazy-ass, over-the-top, evil bad guys. You got their monstrously deformed victims, with the exception of Sean Wallen's character, who, you know, is not as, you know, devolved and traumatized. She humanizes their evil. They're genuine. Like, I mean, she's not done worse by them, but, like, her scarring, like, she even refuses to leave. Like, her total Stockholm syndrome, I can't go out there, and Poole has to come back and rescue her in the third act. Like, that what sinks in, for me, personally, how fucking evil rich white people are. Or mommy and daddy in specific.
Mommy and daddy. It's all in her eyes.
Oh, like, yeah.
I mean, she has plenty of lines in the movie, but it's all physical reaction. And I know
deer in a headlight, kind of just...
There's the old adage that good acting is just reacting. And her... The horror that's pervaded through her eyes is so stark and real.
Even the little moments of rebellion, like, you know, feeding... What's the character's
name? Roach in the walls.
Roach in the walls. And, like, trying... Even though she knows she's going to be physically punished for it, like, her little tiny rebellions that fall beneath her overall submission to the idea of, you know, trying to be perfect. Gotta be good, you know. She's amazing.
The situation is only made more harrowing and bizarre from the revelation that not only is Alice not mommy and daddy's child, making them serial child abductors
and murderers.
But they're also siblings.
So, well, that's just sexy. No. No, that's gross.
Whoa, this...
Like I said, rich white people, they fuck their siblings, you know, it's science.
Well, I mean, going back to, like, you know, Blue Bloods, England, I mean, there is a history.
They might not fuck their siblings, but their cousins are definitely fair game.
Oh, well, that's ridiculous.
But we're America, we do it better. Straight siblings.
Red, white, and blue, Missouri. So, incest, child abduction, child molestation, what the fuck? This is some heavy, heavy material that Wes is bringing light to in a movie that is, by all intents and purposes, pretty goofy.
Like I said, this is like his last attempt at, like, going, like, super fucking hard thematically, and ideologically, I guess, like... Like, you know, daddy's a cannibal. Like, he's eating up Ving Rhames as the other kid's tied up. And, like,
well, the beginning of the movie, like, he's eating what presumably is, you know, one of the kids or a burglar. And there's buckshot in it because he shot them.
Buckshot. And, you know, I mean, he's just, like, as bad as they can get. And, like, Wes Craven, like, even in all his other movies, never, like, this is one of his old school. We're going hard with... When you just break down what happens, multiple traumatized, mutilated children under the basement, murder, child murder, cannibalism, incest, child abuse, you know, that's old school, like, late 70s, early 80s, like, Wes Craven shit. After that, you know, there was, like, Serpent in the Rainbow and, you know, the more serious stuff, the Scream movies, which are elevated slashers, we'll debate later. But you know,
for the record, I nodded yes. I'm not disagreeing with that.
But you know, he knows the fact when he sees it, as in, you know, he knows that the remake of Evil Dead would be an amazing watch.
Oh, fuck me, running! I'm never going to escape this.
No, he never will. One of these days, I'm going to get drunk and snap and like tie him up, and we're going to watch it, and I'm going to record the whole thing, and that's. He's going to disappear, and just an episode's going to appear up on the podcast with a poor imitation of me doing his intro. I'm the mouthpiece of this. I'm Brandon Lane. This is a movie. And then I'm going to disappear.
Well, hopefully there will be a manhunt for you.
In I won't the wake kill of my, you. Of my I won't kill you. I'll just leave
oh, there time. Will be a manhunt. I don't take these things lightly. Motherfucker. The Rent Army will descend upon you in great hordes.
Most of them have seen it.
All of those horrible things that are brought to light in this movie, there's a...
The goofiness, I think, also serves one other factor here that's more practical. The MPAA. If you play this shit straight, it's an X-rated. Automatically, if you don't mitigate it with humor, yeah, it's a hard X. And then it's been edited to the point of being neutered.
The goofiness. Let me ask you this question: do you think if this movie came out in 2020, do you think it'd be rated PG-13?
No, only because of the Ving Rhames torso scene, where he's like, "Yeah, they lift that." If you cut that out and you clean up the language to, I think, what, one or two photos? You get one F-bomb in a PG-13 movie. You do that, definitely PG-13.
I feel like, I mean, at the time, this is definitely an R, but after watching it back this week, I felt like...
It's a soft R.
Yeah.
We've definitely seen worse.
Yeah. And that's not a bad thing, because...
Yeah, every movie doesn't have to be fucking sallow, you know?
They should be. Coming this fall, Sallow Babies, CBS Saturday Mornings.
Oh, I definitely don't ever want to see that.
All right, moving on. One of the hallmarks of Wes Craven's films is his writing of strong female characters. My question to you, is Alice a strong female character?
To survive as long as she did in the environment she did, yes. And it takes a good, strong man to write a female character. I'm just playing. That was just a joke. But yeah, he always does have like good female protagonists. But yeah, absolutely. To survive as long as she had under the horrific circumstances yet, and still have it in her to rebel, like even a little, just feeding Roach and, you know, trying to help Fool. Yeah, she's absolutely a strong character.
I think
she's been wounded, but she's not broken.
The hardest thing... And I'm speaking from the point of not being a writer, but I would imagine the hardest thing about writing strong female characters is like the balance between weakness and vulnerability. On paper, they probably appear to be the same thing, but in reality, they're not the same thing. Like, I'm going to use Jamie Lee Curtis as an example. Jamie Lee Curtis in Halloween, she's not weak.
No.
She's just vulnerable.
She's a person.
And yeah. Under... incompatible or less than writing, she could have been portrayed as weak. Or in the word on the page and how you portray it, like yes. The acting could have made her look weak. But like her and Ellen Ripley and Alien and so on and so forth, like you have characters that have vulnerable moments, but they're not written to be
weak or, you know, they can't forget they're women, you know.
Well, it's not a character that is necessitated upon being rescued by the man. And in fact, one of the hallmarks of slasher films is that you have a strong female protagonist that overcomes the evil in the end.
Okay. Yes, I totally agree with that, but a lot of people in the 80s use that as an excuse to show tits and kill women. Look at us. I'm fine with that.
Listen. We need more of that in movies.
We need a lot more.
We don't have any titties in this movie, and that's the biggest slight against this movie. 1 out of 5. Thumbs down.
Review over.
To be fair, of the women in this movie... no tits were applicable. You have a 17-year-old playing like a 13-year-old. No
Ruby
tits.
Ruby could have popped them titties.
No. Oh, okay. You get a point there.
She's legal.
You get a point there.
But she's also taking care of her cancer-ridden mother.
If it's a bit of a Jim Wynorski movie, there would have been a 20-minute scene of her taking a shower for no reason. It wouldn't have helped the plot, but man, I'd be giving it such a hard thumbs up right now. Misogyny aside, female characters are underwritten generally. And I appreciate that when they're done right, especially in horror movies, you know, they have
when they're done right, it's best in horror movies.
Yeah, like, I agree. Because no one wants to hear a guy scream.
Nobody
wants to hear a guy scream. But if a woman screams from a point of vulnerability and then gets to overcome it, that's a character arc.
That's the underdog story. You think, you know, in your mind, oh, it's the woman is weaker. It's your natural prejudices being played against you. Oh, this big giant killer, you know, the woman's weaker, so you root for the underdog. It's human nature. Even women do that, you know.
Well, I didn't plan on talking about this, but let's view this from the point of view of the movie. It would be so easy for Fool to see their daughter, not interact with her, and just assume she's one of them. And there could be a classist kind of thing right there. But thankfully, Wes Craven... You needed a movie.
Yeah.
You needed a plot of the movie, but that's a good point of view to have. Like, not everybody is.
Not everybody. Evil. And not only that, but like, Fool gets away. He's safe. He goes back to save her.
Yeah, and that goes back to the whole thematic, the dialogue that you read.
Getting
to the, you know, the cliff and all that stuff. And yeah. I think there's definitely some parallels there where, like, he jumps off into the pool or the pond or whatever. But
and he's burned up in the sun, and nobody calls. He blows up the house.
Yeah, I think more movies need a house.
The entire play.
Whether or not Alice is a strong female character or not. She does get some payback for the horrors that she's been subjected to when she kills Mommy with a butcher knife. However, our next character was not so lucky. Ving Rhames as Leroy, probably the biggest star to
move on from this,
this movie. Now, Sean Whalen and some of the other people have worked more consistently, but as far as like higher profile movie work,
there's always going to be another Mission Impossible movie. Ving Rhames got jobs,
and it's funny what I actually have written down here. We'll take it as we come. He was in Jacob's Ladder,
great movie,
probably inspired every horror video game subsequent to it. He was Marcellus Wallace in Pulp Fiction, who may or may not look like a bitch. Does he?
I don't think he looks like a bitch. But
I would never say that to his face because he would fucking kill me. He was in Striptease.
Classic.
Very, very popular movie with me at a certain point.
Oh my God, seeing Jesse naked? Oh. I had to sneak into that. That's the last movie I had to sneak into because they had ushers like there.
I think you're thinking of Showgirls.
Showgirls. Oh, man.
I'm thinking about
Striptease, Demi Moore
with old up Burt Reynolds.
Yeah, Vaseline Burt Reynolds.
Vaseline.
I was going to say, man, I am thinking of Showgirls. I just went and saw Striptease.
Showgirls is a masterpiece directed by Paul Verhoeven.
He's the never done a bad movie ever.
Definition of satire. And that's a movie that fell upon deaf ears now, but
his satire is too highbrow. Like, nobody got the satire of RoboCop. Nobody got the satire of Starship Troopers.
Mainly because those films work in their intended genre, whereas Striptease was so fucking on the nose that like what the fuck is this? But we'll move on.
Okay.
Ving Rhames was in Piranha 3D, which I think is a really, really fun remake.
Ah, fuck it. Yeah, I grabbed you and Amy. I had just seen it. Like, y'all gotta go see it. It's like a roller coaster. And he has the dumbest part in it. He's right by a boat and he just jumps in. It's like the grandma in Dante's Peak that jumps out and dies in the acid water to push him like 3 feet.
Don't they bite his legs off?
Yeah, they bite his legs off and their machine gun legs in the second one.
The second one being Piranha 3DD, which may have the greatest title of any movie of all time.
That's up there.
I don't think I ever even saw the sequel.
It's not good, but it's fun.
Most notably, he was Luther Stickle, and I think I'm pronouncing that right, in all 22 Mission Impossible films, or how many ever they've fucking made. I like the first one, and I've seen maybe two others.
Three. The last two were great. The one with that had the Justice League ruining Jim the Henry Cavill mustache.
Mustache, yeah.
It was worth it. That's a badass movie. I hate Tom Cruise. Spit on him.
Yeah, by the way, we haven't talked about this in a while, but fuck you, Tom Cruise. Fuck you,
Tom Cruise. Don't military people don't look at him.
You piece of shit.
Just pretending that you couldn't be in the Air Force. You're too short.
He definitely couldn't be a Marine.
No, I met a Marine much shorter than him in real life.
Don't.
He couldn't be a Marine because he's just a bad person.
The character of Leroy is one who really throws the plot into motion by devising the scheme to rob the landlord and to be able to pay the rent. Let's talk about the whole series of like them casing the joint and the fun disguises and all that stuff.
I have a couple choice little quotes about.
Please.
I done busted this house's cherry. It's one of my favorite lines of the movie. And also, and I can't remember the context, because I just wrote down quotes as I was watching it, but he's the secretary of pussy. And I could hear him.
That's when they're in the van, and they're kind of like waiting out to see, casing the joint to see like what the schedule is for mommy and daddy being at the house. But yes, prior to us recording this, I had quoted that, but I thought he said the president of pussy, but it was the secretary. He's not quite the president.
We both knew it was a great line, because I just had my cell phone out, like, typing in, Batgirl's burning hell.
I mean, like, doubling back to Wes Craven for a moment, one of my favorite aspects of the film is its dialogue, and particularly the dialogue between Leroy and Fool. My favorite scene between them is when they're breaking into Mommy and Daddy's house. So, Fool says, listen, Leroy, this breaking and entering might not be so smart. I mean, it's the first day of my 13th birthday. Could be unlucky. And Leroy retorts, 13th birthday is unlucky anyways. Too old to get tit, too young to get ass fucked either way. I laughed for like a good 2 minutes straight because I had kind of forgotten before watching this movie how funny it was.
Yeah,
and
me too.
And those lines, they land organically, but they really do bring a lot of levity to the whole shebang.
One of my favorite of Fools is, your father's one sick mother. Actually, your mother's one sick mother too.
Yeah, the dialogue is tremendous. Leroy's smart ass remarks, as funny as they may be, don't help much when daddy filled his ass full of lead. We talked about a little earlier about how there's no glamorization of the kills in the movie. And or really in most of Wes Craven's work. And in context of like Last House on the Left, that really works. However, in this movie, because it does have that weird kind of Twin Peaks kind of tone to it, I think the movie suffers because none of the kills are terribly memorable.
The other guy goes in there first and he's just scared to death. Like, again, one of my lines, you thought he was white before.
Yeah.
Again, yeah, like there's no effective, like I felt really bad when Roach dies. That's the only one that hits you.
We will get to that, and I'm going to be kind of negative on how it's portrayed because I feel like they missed a moment to really bring something to light. Which, Leroy's death may have been underwhelming, but the passing of our next character, which you just brilliantly brought to light, the character of Roach, played by Sean Whalen, the definition of an acting, actor continues to work with roles in Batman Returns. He was in Revenge of the Nerds 3, which our good friend Mick Strawn did the production design for. Shout out Mick Strawn. I'm actually wearing a Rabbit Hole t-shirt right now.
He really is.
Shout out to our friends at Dewback Discussion.
Meanwhile,
Network.
I'm more loyal and brand loyal, so I'm wearing a Fat Tony shirt.
That he is. Hey, but I mean, these guys are our
absolutely.
They're our podcast network, and Mick is, and TJ, who's a bunny rabbit on this shirt, both good friends. He was in Jury Duty with Pauly Shore. We won't hold that against him.
At the time when I was young, I'm sorry, I saw it and I laughed my ass off. I don't know what was wrong with us kids and teens in the 90s.
To be fair, Sean Whalen is really good in that. He plays a lot kind of like the creepy, like leering kind of guy. And this is not no knock on him because he is just a really genuine nice guy. But he plays that character to such a degree that, and unfortunately, he's probably been typecast. But work is better than no work, and
exactly.
He's been able to get roles outside of that as well. So I nothing but respect to Sean Whalen.
I'm waiting on the one role. I'm letting you go down his list, but you better not miss it.
Thank you. Thank you so much for giving us what we're going to shoot to for in a few moments. He was in Idle Hands. You know,
I love that movie.
One of the pretty good
fun horror movie of the 90s. Yeah. Jessica Biel and Brown Panties at the end. Fuck. The angel, the little...
Woo! She was a hot tamale back then. She's still hot, but yeah. Like, you know, 19-year-old.
Nice.
My pants just erupted into flames. He was in Charlie's Angels with Bill Murray, who was in Ghostbusters, and you just got busted.
I gotta stop you to go back. My hands weren't idle after that movie. But damn, I missed it. It was too late, but it was too good not to say.
He was in Laid to Rest, directed by our good friend Rob Hall from Almost Human FX. We're still waiting on that third Laid to Rest movie. It got crowdfunded, I believe, so the whole COVID thing's kind of slowed production down.
Mm-hmm.
But shout out to Rob Hall. May need to get him on the podcast eventually. Rob Zombie's Halloween 2, and he also worked with Rob Zombie again on 3 from Hell. Both good additions to movies that are maybe... not at the top of the list, but we'll bring light to them all the same. My mom and people from that ilk would know him from 34 episodes of The Bold and the Beautiful. And he also has a reoccurring role on the show Superstore. I just started watching.
I gave in. Hulu kept putting it on after whatever we watched, and we finally just gave in. It's a great show.
It is a great show. Now, his character, he's... playing into the whole stereotype. Yeah. He's the guy that like puts on chapstick really slow and just leers at people. And one of my favorite episodes, I just watched it a couple of days ago, the whole entire series, is their Halloween episode from the third season. So they've got the whole store decorated with like shit, and they find his fucking dead body because the previous season there was a tornado hit and, you know, people disappeared. But they find his dead body in the walls, which has to be a People Under the Stairs reference because his character wrote lives between the walls. But his dead body, they're waiting for a coroner to show up. And a guy dressed like a coroner shows up, and they're like dragging his dead body around the fucking store. It's good stuff. Really, really good stuff. But his best role came in the form of a patrol cop from the Slayer music video Repentless.
Yeah.
And this is being turned into a movie. They're doing, it's live concert footage. It's the music videos from that album. And I don't know if it's going to be coming to theaters because of all the COVID stuff. But Slayer getting a really, really awesome send-off, you know, their final tour and everything. Slayer. So, Sean Whalen, cool to get to play a part in that.
He's also the Aaron Burr Got Milk guy from the peanut butter ad. He eats the peanut butter sandwich, and he has his whole house surrounded by Aaron Burr stuff, and he calls the radio, Aaron Burr! That was like the first and most effective Got Milk commercial.
I had forgotten that until you just mentioned
That's what I was waiting to see if you got it. Like, I'm sorry, that was a cultural touchstone at the time.
All joking aside, Roach is the heart of the movie and probably the most remembered character from The People Under the Stairs. Roach is, you know, the figurative thorn in the side of Daddy because he's the one that got away and he's been hiding in the walls and he's being aided and abetted by Alice. Now, earlier I had mentioned about Alice being kept alive because she had not heard, seen, or spoken evil, but Roach is the victim of this because his tongue has been severed, and what a great makeup effect.
Yeah, it really is.
But I want to talk about Sean's performance despite not being able to speak and how impressive it is to be able to convey emotion and be not only like the character everybody remembers, but be the character everybody remembers despite being able to give any dialogue, especially considering the dialogue in this movie is memorable in of itself.
Oh, yeah.
So, what do you think about his performance?
I love it. Like, he's just always rebellious. I mean, there's the sad, forlorn sounds, but for most of the movie, when he's on screen, he's got a smile, he's ready to help, he's not defeated yet until he gets defeated. And they did miss. It is thrown off a little in the background. Not in the background, like, oh, God, and then they just move on a little too fast from it.
One of the things that really I found interesting in doing my research is, and this movie being probably a good reason as to why he's fallen into this field is that he's actually an acting teacher now. I mean, he still acts. Yeah. He still acts consistently, but he's an acting teacher. Seeing him act in this movie, man, if he can teach 1% of, you know, just the... I mean, it's almost like mime, what he's doing.
Yeah.
But being able to convey that kind of sympathy, and because, like you said, he's not an unhappy character. He's sort of enjoying
his... He taunts and teases. Yeah. Now, I mean, he gets Daddy to destroy his house practically, just shotgunning the shit out of everything.
But him being an acting teacher, I found that to not be, you know, illogical in the least. I can see him definitely being an acting teacher. So probably my favorite performance in the movie overall, the one that, like if I were to separate myself, like if I hadn't watched this movie for a couple of years, it's the one that's going to stick with me just because it's these. He's not the person under the stairs. But in some ways, he is.
He's like their mascot. He's the one that got away. He's their aspirational character.
I think Sean is incredible in this film, and I am not the only one. In fact, Wes Craven has gone on record saying that Sean's performance was one of his favorites from the films he worked on. But you don't want to hear what I have to say about it. You don't want to hear what Fat Tony has to say. So it's with great pleasure I introduce Sean Whalen himself, who is kind enough to record this segment talking about working with the late, great Wes Craven on The People Under the Stairs. Take it away, Sean.
Hey, everybody. This is Sean Whalen, a.k.a. Roach from People Under the Stairs, and I have been enlisted by the Rants from the Black Lodge podcast to talk about having the opportunity to work with legendary director Wes Craven. He was so nice. He was so sweet. He was definitely not what you pictured. He wasn't creepy and strange. He was just like the mellowest guy in the world. He just had, obviously, an active and kind of frightening imagination. I remember one great story was he was just making the movie, and the suits come down every once in a while when scripts and budgets go over, and they came down to the set, the suits, and no one could find him. They wanted to talk to him, and Jan Birch, who was the main stairmaster, went up to the roof and found Wes sitting on the roof and smoking a joint, and he was like, what are you doing up here? And he said, well, I'm just waiting for them to leave so I can finish my movie. He was a true artist. He stayed up there. They left, didn't get the answers they wanted on the budget, and he went back to making the movie. And obviously, Wes was right. We were number one for 6 weeks, and I was going through my stuff today and found a beautiful letter from Wes thanking me for my performance. He was just a genuinely sweet and kind man, one of the best, and probably why he's a legend.
We want to thank Sean for participating in this episode. He really went above and beyond, so I want all of you out there in the Rant Army to show your gratitude by giving him a follow on Twitter at Sean_Whalen. Thank you so much, Sean, for giving us that.
Absolutely.
Thank really, you. Really, really cool. Couple things before we move on to our additional cast. I want to talk about the editing of the film, and then we'll go back to Roach's unfortunately passing in the film. This movie is edited like an action movie. It's so kinetic, it's fast paced, and there is no wasted motion. Like if you watch the beginning of the movie, basically until the point where Fool escapes, it's so streamlined. Like there nothing about it is needless.
I never put thought into it, but yeah, you're absolutely right.
And I think that's a positive of the film because you can watch it and it just flies by. You're in and you're out. Where this comes into problem with me, and there's only one specific instance that I can cite, and that's Roach's death. So let's talk about Roach's death to set the stage. So, you know, they're kind of roaming between the walls, them being Roach and Fool, and Roach gets winged, and they end up in the basement with the people under the stairs. Well, they climb into the furnace, and Roach unceremoniously dies. He just, last breath escapes his body, and he's dead. So, you know, Fool climbs up, and Daddy lights a fire and burns his body, and you don't have that realization or that separation of the action to really let this death
emotional closure.
Yeah, to sink in. So I think that's a misstep. But as far as the editing for the rest of the movie, it's terrific.
Yeah, like you said, it goes. When it starts going, it moves.
And I know that like genre bending became more prevalent in the 90s, but I can't think of a horror movie that's edited quite this way prior to this.
No, I think you're right. It's more typical slow burn, two camera, kind of like point counterpoint kind of stuff in horror movies.
There's points where it's something straight out of an action movie. The part where we kind of referenced this earlier, where he's dropping the bricks down the chimney. But when Alice and Fool slide down the chimney, that's straight out of a fucking action movie. The way it's shot, almost the speed, it's sped up just a little to add a little more kinetic energy to it. But yeah, I think that leaving a little space right there, slowing the movie down just so you could feel the weight of that, would have added a lot to the film that is lacking otherwise. Roach's death is avenged by Fool, who blows Daddy the fuck up with dynamite in the closer of the film, when he finds the room full of the gold and all that stuff. And there's a really nice, he tricks him into thinking he's counting the change, the gold back there, because he kind of sticks the gold coins into the candle, and as it burns, that's smart. I would have never thought to do anything like that, and I don't know if a 13-year-old kid would come to that point, but Wes is writing from a, yet again, that whole mastermind kind of trap mentality, and he's outsmarting the one percenter type, so I do really like that. Let's move on to our additional cast. We'll touch on them very briefly. You've lamented your love for Ruby, played by the very, very talented Kelly Jo Minter. You've probably seen her in quite a few things. She was in Mask, the Rocky Dennis version, not the Jim Carrey movie. She was Maria in The Lost Boys, which I had completely forgot about until doing my research. Like, oh, yeah.
Yeah?
There you go. Because when I think about female characters in The Lost Boys, Star is the first one.
Star is it.
I'm still pissed off to this day that Joel Schumacher, because he's not a fan of women because he's gay, but he didn't give me.
Not
a,
that there's anything.
There's,
wrong
no,
with
there's
that.
Nothing wrong with that. But come on, give me some fucking titties in the sex scene. I need to know that Michael is hitting that hard, man. Yeah. Come on,
it's just good storytelling.
it is the best storytelling. Yeah. She's also Cheryl in the criminally underrated slasher Popcorn. I actually got this for Christmas.
Oh my god, yeah, I forgot that.
Lanyard Gates. It's a cool movie setting. It's sort of like the dark version of is it Joe Dante that made Matinee? Kind of the whole
same
premise. Yeah,
it always makes me sad because the actor was dying of it. The bad guy actor was dying of AIDS during that, and you could see like the little sarcoma starting to happen on his nose.
I didn't know that.
That's the one thing. That's why that movie always stays with me.
But yeah, I just rewatched it around Christmas, and
great movie,
really, really good, underrated, and the biggest strike against it came out in the 90s, so it just kind of fell in the shuffle because people were jumping off of this whole slasher revolution that we love and revere now, but it was, passe at the time. She's best remembered as Yvonne in Nightmare on Elm Street Part 5.
I'm sorry, Rant Army. I'm sorry.
And a little bit of trivia about this, and something I didn't realize until fairly recently, but in the Friday the 13th video game, there is a female character who has the exact bathing suit as one of the customizable costume options as Yvonne in Nightmare on Street 5, I always said Friday 13th Part 5. But that just shows to show you how deep they're Friday 13th,
genre.
The horror genre as a whole. We have Jeremy Roberts as Spencer. We didn't really talk a lot about Spencer, but he's the other character who plays a part in them looting the house. And he gets an awesome death scene, albeit off screen, because they just find his body and his hair has just become stark white.
You thought he was white before.
Yeah, exactly. But very much like Henry Bowers in It, just seeing something so horrific that he, died of a heart attack and, and couldn't go on, but he poses as a like a meter
gas company guy
and kind of gets his way in there, but Mommy knows he's fucking like, oh, there's nothing in here, blah blah blah. Well, and then you don't see it on screen, which I applaud the restraint sometimes and not seeing the things, because I think the reveal of finding his body is a good moment. Yeah. But contemporarily, in terms of 1991, I could see where people were like, well, I want to see him get killed.
Yeah.
So, take that as you will. He's had a pretty good acting career. He was in Mask, the Jim Carrey version, not the Rocky Dennis version. So, you have the flip between him and Kelly Jo Menner. Star Trek VI, one of the better sequels of the original cast. He was tons of TV acting, L.A. Law, 21 Jump Street, and he was even in an episode of Freddy's Nightmares. So, connection to back to Kelly Jo Menner and the whole Nightmare series. Bill Cobbs as Grandpa Booker. You've probably seen him in the original Taking of Pelham 1-2-3, not the version with
Ethan Hawke.
Lawrence
Fishburne.
No, you're thinking of Assault on Precinct.
Taking
of Pelham 1-2-3.
John Travolta.
John Travolta. Yeah, John Travolta. Yes.
Again, I keep mixing up movies in this one.
He was in The Bodyguard, Demolition Man, which we found out pretty recently is going to get a sequel, evidently, long after the fact.
Those long-time sequels incoming, there's like, not all of them are Blade Runner 2049. Some of them are Dumb and Dumber 2. or Zoolander 2. I wanted them both to be better than they are.
No comment on Zoolander 2. I was very disappointed. The Hudsucker Proxy, he was in that great movie. Ghost of Mississippi. And, of course, the greatest film about animals who played sports, the incomparable 90s classic Air Bud, which everybody loves. I hate Air Bud. I hated it. I hate Air Bud.
No.
You know, as far as, like, people that are important to this movie, and I don't want to discredit him because he also gave us an awesome intro for this movie. You have the chief of the people under the stairs, Jan Birch, as the Stairmaster. I want to comment really quickly on physically. His face was made for prosthetic makeup.
Oh, absolutely.
Very angular, very, like, I can see a makeup guy just seeing his face and be like, oh my God, I could do this XYZ with him. And you made a point earlier about saying that how you read the title of the film and you think the people under the stairs are going to be the villains. So to put makeup on this guy and kind of put this ugly visage on him, but him turn out to be
A victim,
and consequently one of the heroes of the piece. That's kind of an interesting parallel, because he looks fucking terrifying.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
As a kid, that was the only time in this movie that scared me. Now, I didn't see it in the theater, neither did you, and I think I actually saw it on Cinemax. My aunt had, you know, one of those giant satellites that, you know, would
get anything.
You had to rotate it like,
yeah,
35 degrees to get a channel, and you know what I mean? Like, it was a whole ordeal, because that was not something you just did. You had to wait for it to position to a different part of your yard to be able to even pick that stuff up. But I remember seeing it, and it absolutely fucked me up because of him. And you view it through the eyes of a 8-year-old or whatever. And, you know, if everything's, it's very superficial. So even though, like, they end up not being the villains, I think I still perceive them as being scary and, you know, not.
Roach and his face are, like, one of the few things I took until I rewatched it. Like, if I thought of that movie, those were the images that pop up in your head, you know?
And
Gimp Suit Daddy.
Absolutely, Gimp Suit Daddy. One of the best things about horror films is being able to, in terms of acting, is to be able to lend yourself in a visual way, because I feel like we're more attached, especially in film and just in the aesthetic of something, but more than anybody else in the movie, that's the purveying image, at least for me, that I associate with the movie. So, yeah. Jan, very limited screen time, but absolutely makes the most of it. You may have seen him in Minute Work, pretty recently. He played Dr. Fibes in the movie Death House, which is kind of like the Expendables of horror.
Yeah, I just watched it recently.
Not a great movie, but I love that his character is named Dr. Fibes, because I am a huge Dr. Fibes fan, as in the Vincent Price character. He's in Tim and Eric's awesome show, Great Job, for some episodes. Brooklyn Nine-Nine, The Young and Restless. But my favorite of his roles is as credited in the credits, Weirdo, from Slumber Party Massacre 3. He's the MacGuffin. You think he's going to be the villain, but he actually ends up being the guy who distracts you from the yuppie who ends up being the villain.
Again, rich people.
Concord International Pictures, which was Roger Corman's studio. They produced a bunch of low-budget horror films in the early 90s, and that's one of my personal favorites from that time being. As for the rest of the people under the stairs, we got Nick Kramer, Robert Michael, Earl Dax, David Robinson, Greg Kotzer, Daniel Wintry, and Burton Pierce. I feel like it was necessary to give them a little bit of love because they don't have character names, and I mean, they're in the background, but the movie is called The People Under the Stairs.
Yeah,
how
we
do
need
you
to know about the people?
How do you not give them any credit? A little bit of trivia, general trivia about the movie. Reportedly, Hilary Swank auditioned for the role of Roach. Talk about a different movie that would have been.
Damn.
Wes Craven, a lot of times when he would write scripts, he wouldn't write characters as being gendered. They would just be
who they are,
and that way it left it open. And like, if you could audition, have more possibilities when you audition people. So, I mean, the role would have been completely different. Although I think they went with the right decision.
I do. It would have been interesting to see a failure of a daughter.
She's an Academy Award winning actress who would have had an early role in a horror film, which is almost a given. They all kind of start from their roots from horror, but that would have been a weird jumping off point from her. She's also in the worst Karate Kid movie, but we won't hold that against her.
No, she's not. That movie doesn't exist. Bad.
Reportedly, before his passing, Wes Craven was developing a TV version of The People Under the Stairs for the Sci-Fi Channel. First strike against it, it would have been on the Sci-Fi Channel, who...
I'm sorry, Channel Zero's the shit, and it's on the Sci-Fi.
I was going to say, even when they get it right, their marketing is fucking horrible, so it probably would have died a swift death.
I'll agree to that.
Better than the CW, which would have been the death knell for any horror property. Do you think this would translate well into a series? Maybe
like
not
HBO.
Maybe like not like a
limited series.
A limited series, like 8 episodes.
Yeah, I could see that definitely. Like, I mean, and then they could. I'd like to see that taken seriously, and the concept being used to either scare or fuck you up.
I almost feel like if, God forbid, if this were remade or adapted into a series, they'd have to take it into a tonally different direction, because
you couldn't.
I don't think you can get this type of comedy. It's too self-referential. I don't know. If you were to do this now, I feel like it would come off more hokey. Like, this film is pretty well balanced in its comedy and horror, but because you have somebody like Wes Craven behind it to know how much is too much, and I feel like they would hang their hat a little much one area or another. So I don't know. That could have been cool, but it's probably best that it didn't happen.
Yes.
Mommy and Daddy's guard dog, Prince, was actually played by 4 different Rottweilers. We touched on this a little earlier. You don't work with kids. You don't work with animals in movies, and this film has both. That's a testament to Wes Craven, the patience of Job.
He seemed like a very patient, laid-back guy. I don't know. I mean, he could have been a tyrannical monster, but he just seemed pretty always laid-back.
Everybody seemed to...
I've never heard bad stories about him.
Everybody was very complimentary about his temperament, and he would, tuck himself away and would deal with whatever internal strife he had rather than take it out on the crew. But working with animals, even trained ones, like professional trained animals, it's really, time is money on a film set. And so to have an animal that's going to dick around and
waste
you're shooting on film,
crew, yeah.
Film back then, film stock is expensive. So They got the most out of that dog. I mean, he's a character in of himself.
Oh yeah,
you've got those great moments of the dog chasing them through the walls, and the dog's death scene is actually played almost for comedy, but at the same time, kind of sad because it is a dog and doesn't know any better. But he thinks he's killed Fool, but
killed the dog.
Killed a dog in a movie, which is kind of taboo in of itself, but no kid death, so instant zero rating in this movie.
Yeah.
Butterfly McQueen, who played the maid in Gone with the Wind, at one point had actually lived in the house they filmed in.
Wow.
Yeah. The house used in The People Under the Stairs was used for the interior shots for Rob Zombie's Halloween as well. And I don't know specifically, but I'm going to say it's probably the house, the actual Myers house. In particular, the scenes where it's happening in present day, where Laurie and him are fighting, and like he comes through the walls. Which now, in retrospect, I'm thinking like, is that Rob Zombie paying homage? I don't know. It may
probably
just be,
not.
Probably I don't. But then again, I don't know.
Rob Zombie's a film fanatic.
He's a huge film fanatic. So I don't know. The house is almost a character unto itself, and we haven't really spoke much about it. So before we move on to our fan questions, I want to touch on the production design, specifically about the house. The house, in context of the film, is an old funeral home. So, you have the hallmarks of all that, the nice lobby, the downstairs, you have the crematorium there, which I don't think they're actually using as a crematorium. Well, I guess they do because they burn up
roach.
But they're using it for heat of the house. Production design, I didn't really have an appreciation for it as much as I do now prior to me becoming friends with Mick Strawn, production designer on, Candyman and Boogie Nights and on down the line, Nightmare Films. But after watching this, it just the intentional detail of everything to really just sell how creepy this film is in terms of the house. But the cool thing, there's a part where the cops show up and they're checking in on them because of reports of child abuse. And they flip these switches, and there's almost like the horror movie setting that they have, where like they turn them on and like, or turn it off, and like, oh, the house is nice and it's old and worn and lived in, but it's better lit. It has a more creepy grandma aesthetic rather than hellish asylum for people under the stairs that it once has. But the other thing that really stood out to me I don't know why it just gave me shivers, is there's a part where they're first breaking in, they being Ving Rhames' character and Brandon Adams, and there's just this pile of dead flies in the corner. Like, that made my skin crawl, like, genuinely. So production design gets A+ for me.
Yeah.
Where do you think this stands in like the pantheon of like horror movie houses? I mean, I guess the number one would be Amityville Horror.
I mean, it's again just like this is the cream of the crop of Wes Craven's B material. Not to insult the man at all, but I think it's like, again, this might be my '90s bias. It's great for a '90s movie.
I think that's fair. Okay, so we didn't get a ton of questions this month, but the ones we got, I think, are really good, with the exception of the joke question we always get from Titty Flippin' Travis. First question from Brad McKinney. I'm always amazed at how the movies never get brought up when discussing Wes Craven's best movies, and in my humble opinion, it might actually be my favorite. Where would you rank it among his movies, and that it being The People Under the Stairs? Would you put it top five?
It'd be five. It would be the number. It would be the fifth one.
I mean, if I'm really to think about it, me personally, I would rank it above Screen from my personal taste. But I mean, from societal and cultural impact, it definitely wouldn't outrank that.
Let's just go personal taste.
Well, okay. Nightmare One, number two for me would, Man, this is harder than I thought it would be. Hills Have Eyes is always going to be up there for me. Last House on the Left, albeit a movie that like I wouldn't put on just to put on. But if I'm in the mood for something fucked up, that's, you know, top three that kind of comes to mind. I'll, for the sake of argument, I'll say four or five for me.
Yeah, that's about me where I'd put it.
Fair enough. All right, this question comes from Dustin Mattson of 3B Productions on YouTube. Please go give them a subscribe. They produce some really good content. When Full escapes and comes back for Alice, did her parents already have the tape recordings of them saying the prayer? Then there's an awful lot of accomplished after he escapes. They fill the pond, talk to the police, hide all the weapons, clean up the blood, record a prayer, and set up everything in case Full comes back. How much time would that actually take? Well, first up, there's one mess up in your question. They actually didn't fill the pond. They actually drained the pond because that's how he escapes the first time. Yeah. He falls in the water and it breaks his fall. And I think she actually says something like they filled it up with spikes or broken glass or something and they drained it out. But I get your point. This, I think for me, this just boils down to movie mindset. Movie logic. Yeah.
I have a different take. These people have been doing this for years, so they're prepared for contingencies. Okay, they found a weakness, the pond. They got out. We'll fix that. They might have had the prayer already set up.
I think they did have the prayer already set up, and them draining the pond is probably not the
longest,
But the cleaning up of, like, the, you know, everything of just... Because, like I said before, there's literally like a switch, like, horror movie, regular setting. So it's almost like they flip that and like, oh, now they're just the great American, you know, couple. And this
we just got away with it as a movie. It's movie logic.
But in logical terms, like in reality, there's
minimum 5 hours.
Very little chance that this would add up in time because it's already nighttime when Full escapes. And we know this happens over the course of just one day.
So
the time frame fudged a little bit, but that's movie magic for you. Our final question, as always, comes from Titty Flip and Travis. Do you think Mommy and Daddy made homemade porno, and would you rather watch it or take your chances with the cannibal kids?
I'm actively looking for Mommy and Daddy's homemade porn. Yeah, you got me fucked up.
They're incestuous gimp porn.
That's peak sexy to me. Like,
we didn't really touch much on the weird sadomasochistic element to it.
Because I can only get so hard.
it's there, but it's not really explored.
I think it's a dig at like the perversions of rich people. Like, again, there's no reason for the random gimp suit. They don't seem to have.
I'm gonna from the perspective of why he put that in here. And this is not like a. I could see where this would be a production company or a releasing. We need an identifiable character to market, but I think he was smart enough to realize that like. If you put somebody in a costume that's going to stand out, if they have a really striking silhouette or a visual, that's going to give you a character. It's just funny because, like, it's probably, like, the fifth thing I think of because there's so much other more identifiable things in the movie.
Yeah.
But I think that's probably the mindset of why there's the weird S&M gimp character.
Yeah. I want the Mommy and Daddy porn of those characters, not like in general incest porn. Just those, because I'm a big David Lynch fan. I love Twin Peaks. I like redheads. You know, Daddy knows how to fuck.
Okay, well, that brings us to another point before we close out. When he takes Alice to the attic and he ties her up,
and he's
in his gimp gear, and he like goes up there because he's looking for Full, and she's actually like Full was in the chimney and he knocked the peg out that's holding her arms above her head where she's shackled, so she's having to like hold her arms back up there so he doesn't realize that she has escaped, you know, for lack of a better term. But he goes up there and he just starts rubbing his crotch, which that's
disturbing.
That genuinely got me. I mean, he stops just enough because mommy's like, hey, come down here, blah, blah. And so he stops, because that definitely would have been an R rating. Probably X-rating. Pushing this to
it's already R.
Yeah. Well, I'm saying like yeah. I mean, that would have been like the tipping point, like if you had hadn't done anything else in the movie. But yeah, back to the question, do you take your chance with the cannibal kids, or are you going to whack it to some mommy and daddy incest porn?
I'm whacking it. I'm going to whack it tonight thinking about it.
Okay.
No, not really.
Fair enough. I mean, this is America. I wouldn't dare tell you what to do. Okay. Iran Army, I think we spent enough time under the stairs for a while, but we'll be back on July 1st with a new episode. And just so you know where to find it, please subscribe to the Rants from the Black Lodge podcast on one of the many platforms we're available on, including iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, Spotify, Podbean, Player FM, iHeartRadio. Find us on Twitter at Rants Black Lodge. Stop by our homepage at JuicyKruger.com. And for the love of Cthulhu, buy a t-shirt from our web store at rantarmy.com. So for Fat Tony, I'm Brandon A. Lane. Till next month, Rant Army, keep marching.